Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Down in Front. Our movie this week is... The movie, 2001, A Space Odyssey, the 1968
space movie
by Stanley Kubrick. Go ahead and pop in your DVD. Press play. Wait. Listen. Wait.
There's nothing wrong with your picture.
Listen. Enjoy the experience.
It's black.
It's a Kubrick film. Enjoy the experience for 3 minutes until the music has led you to the reveal of the logo. MGM logo pops up for a second, pops down, and when it disappears, press pause on your DVD. We've pressed pause here. In a second, I'll say 3, 2, 1, unpause. I'll press play. You'll press play. And we'll watch the movie together in perfect sync. It'll be like any other commentary, except, of course, this time with four friends in your head. And your friends this week are myself, as always, T. Christie, my friend Brian Space Thinifter.
Hello, Dave.
New friend Serge Space Del Pierre.
Hello, Teague.
And Trey the Amazing Stokes, I guess.
I enjoy doing Down in Front, and I have a stimulating relationship with you.
Now we'll get to
I thought I was going to be the only one to pop out with the Douglas Rain impression, but clearly that was silly of me to think so.
2001. We have a long history with Kubrickian movies, and if you want another exploration of how we feel about Kubrick and enlightenment on that subject, go to the Full Metal Jacket commentary. Also really good. But this one's great, too.
So makes a great double feature.
Oh, it's an excellent. Enjoy your next 7 hours of visceral filmmaking.
2001 and Full Metal Jacket.
However, I come to this with a similar opinion. I came to Full Metal Jacket with... That movie just kind of bores and aggravates me, and I don't understand why. And after Full Metal Jacket, Eddie kind of laid it out for me in a way that we sort of came to a conclusion that I was able to go, I get it. Kubrick, it's more visceral. It's more a dreamlike state. It's more laying out the thing for you. And this, even more so than Full Metal Jacket, is, you know, you go to the theater with your family, and you experience the theater. Yeah.
You put on the good shoes. It was the 60s. It was the late
60s. And there's a major...
CinemaScope movie.
Yeah. And for all the differences that this movie has with others just by the nature of being Kubrickian, a Kubrick film, it also outlays my experience by about 40 years of generational development.
Yeah.
Because the first time I saw... Actually, more than 40 years, if we look at it that way. I think I saw this just a few years ago, and it came out in 68. So... This movie for any
definitely
number
not an MTV style movie.
Yeah, for any number of reasons, this movie didn't work for me, and it's hard to isolate variables when there's so many differences. But I'm the only guy here that has openly stated a distaste for this film. Brian,
we'll see if you live through the hours.
Yeah, you're the only guy here who would not sleep with this movie.
We brought in an expert just to overcome me.
That's right.
Brian, how do you feel about 2001? Never mind.
Oh!
How do you feel about 2001?
Hey. I love it dearly. It's been my favorite movie for a long, long time. And a lot of that, I think part of that at least is me being a film snob. So now that I'm trying to shed my snobbery.
As you said in Full Metal Jacket, a hobbying snobbist.
Yes, exactly. But it's still a movie that I love very, very deeply. And essentially because, as we talked about in Full Metal Jacket commentaries, Kubrick is about the experience. So here's the experience of being at war. And 2001 is, here's the experience of being in space.
Which is why it takes forever and nothing happens.
Yes, but if there's one thing I want more dearly than anything else in existence, it's to be in space. So this gives it to me in space.
So the movie could have been longer. If it was like 3 or 4 weeks, then
if you could make this movie 6 months long, I would be down.
Yeah, okay.
They made an excellent screensaver that you'd probably love.
Yeah.
Now, you also made a really
don't
funny...
think I haven't stared at that screensaver for a long time.
Put it outside your window.
You also made a joke in Transformers that Trey mentioned and I want to bring up.
It might be very insightful.
What's an easy, insightful way to juxtapose Stanley Kubrick with the modern film going audience?
Stanley Kubrick is Michael Bay sped up very, very fast with a lot of other tricks.
Other way around.
You did that backwards.
So. Oh, did I? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, the conclusion we came to in Full Metal Jacket is Kubrick is about the experience. And I think we came to a similar conclusion, or at least I did, with Transformers, where Michael Bay, if he's trying to tell a story, he's not doing it too well. But he definitely conveys an experience. And there's two philosophies of filmmaking you could take, where is filmmaking about telling a story, or is it about presenting an experience and developing you in that experience?
Yeah. So, and I think the difference, though, is just so we can keep our intellectual cred, is that Kubrick's experience has ideas in it, whereas Michael Bay's experiences so far are, you know, the experience of being hit in the side of the head with a brick.
There are certainly more philosophical underpinnings to Kubrick than there are Michael Bay.
Exactly.
So for all that... Michael Bay is Stanley Kubrick on speed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
And that's not necessarily... I when you said that, I was kind of like, huh. You might be honest.
That's weirdly insightful. Now, we're going to come back to Serge. Trey, what's your relationship with 2001?
Oh, well, more so than Star Wars, which, you know, for so many people my age. And,
I didn't know you liked Star Wars.
I'm familiar with it. You know, 2001 and Star Wars were basically sort of the bracket of my youth through high school experience, which between the two of them and everything that happened in between is why I'm here today. I mean, 2001, when I was like, what, the age of 8, seeing in the theater saying, that's awesome, and really awakening me to, you know, movies as a thing that humans were making somewhere on the planet. Humans were doing this. It wasn't something that just came out of the air and you watched on television. And there was, and we have a copy. I love that we have a copy of it sitting on the table right here. There's a book here that Sarah's brought because my copy long ago disintegrated. I'm so amazed to see this
from
book
overreading.
Again. Yeah, it's called The Making of Kubrick's 2001. It came out at the time, which again, as I've said otherwise in other commentaries, is very rare in the 60s and 70s. No one gave a damn about how movies got made. You didn't have all this making of E! Channel. Let's go behind the scenes of Planet of the Apes and see what went on. I mean, when you found a making of book or video, it was like gold to actually be able to see what it was like to make something. So this book here, The Making of 2001, which is very technical and goes into great depth about it, and also covers the experience of, you know, how they made it and how they wrote it and their critical reception afterwards and all the crazy audience responses. It's a great book. And what's this other one you have here? The Lost Worlds of 2001. That's Arthur C. Clarke's memoir of the making of.
Right, and it's a collection of stories also, yeah, having to do with,
you know, so it's just it's just something to put on the drugstore rack, you know, that says 2001 on it because it's a hot movie. But it was such a hot movie that people actually were willing to read books about it. Anyway, so that book really opened my eyes to this visual effects thing. And there's names in there like Doug Trumbull, that young wunderkind. And I think I could be wrong. I think Dennis Muren at the age of, you know, 2.5 might have worked on this movie.
I think everyone of that generation in special effects did, yeah.
Yeah, because there was nothing else to work on.
Except for Dykstra.
Yeah. And Dykstra was involved. I'm not sure. But anyway, so The Making of 2001, and just reading that book cover to cover, and then living my whole, you know, high school years and getting a camera and starting to make movies, and then bang, out comes this Star Wars movie. And then, you know, I said, okay, that's it. I'm going to go to California and go to school and try and get into this movie business.
You should get around to that.
Yeah, one of these days I hope to succeed.
And our guest this week is Serge.
Hi.
Who is here for overwhelming knowledge of 2001.
Overwhelming love for 2001.
What's your relationship with 2001? What are your similarities with Trey in that regard?
Well, Trey and I are about the same age, so it basically came out, and, you know, when we were very young and impressionable, and at the time I really loved anything about space, and I watched Star Trek. I was watching Star Trek with my mother, and when it was on NBC on a black and white television, and then my 7th birthday came up, my dad said, "We're going to go see 2001. I'm like, "Yes, yes, space." So he brings me down to the big Cinerama movie theater in Montreal. I think it was called the Imperial, and we're watching it, and we snuck in some sodas and everything. I was really excited, and then it
you
all
it
starts.
Right.
Oh, we did it way right. And then it all comes up, and it's, you know, and first of all, it's apes and everything. There's a monolith. I'm like, "What's going on?" Okay, fine. And then there's space, and I'm loving it. And I love the whole thing, but I remember like getting about 3/4 of the way through, and I keep asking my dad, what's going on? Shh. What's going on? I mean, I was having, as a 7-year-old, I was having a hard time understanding what's going on.
Frustrated, yeah. Like I did as a 20-year-old.
Yeah,
like,
what's
going on?
The thing is, you don't get the movie when you watch it. I mean, but
and anybody who says they do is a liar.
Yeah, for those of us, you know, and you know, we did further reading. It wasn't until, yeah, you know, I read up on the book. I read the Sentinel, the original story. I read The Making of 2001. I was like, oh, that's what they were going for.
So you're 7-year-old. Right. 7 years old. You're sitting there. You're watching it.
Loving it. So I mean, I just loved everything about it. And then, you know, I collected like bubblegum with the little wrappers that they had, like images from 2001, anything I can get them. I was of that age. And then, you know, then I think it came back, this is before, you know, the time of like, you know, home video and VHS and all that kind of thing.
I hope they show that in the theater again someday.
Exactly.
Or maybe once or twice on television.
And that's what they did back in like, whatever, 71, 72. Then they bring it out in the theater for a couple of weeks and you go see it again, and then they take it away for a few years, and then they come back again in the mid 70s. So I saw it like maybe 3 times during the 70s. And then later on, when VHS came along, was able to see it. And the first time I saw it on VHS was at my friend Eddie's place on a little, 12-inch black and white TV. And we're like watching, like, oh my God, oh, look at that. There's the Discovery. Oh, it's so tiny, but this is great. You know, we brought back our memories of it because we really liked science and we liked space and everything about it. And it just, you know, captured, it was just a very captive experience on the whole thing. Apart from the fact that it was a Kubrick film, which is a whole other thing, it itself just brought you into space like no other film had, not Star Trek. I mean, I guess, you know, Star Wars did later. Star Wars like wiped it off the map because Star Wars like, okay, now you're here and we're going to move the camera. You know, 2001, we're not moving the camera, but it's okay. Kind of thing.
So has your admiration for 2001 grown in the intervening years, or are you still the 7-year-old when you watch it? I mean, do you respect it for new reasons that you found as you've gone along?
It's changed depending on the experience.
Assuming you hadn't read the book. Or I assume you didn't know much about sci-fi when you were 7 years old.
No. I knew sci-fi from Star Trek, and I really loved – I mean, Star Trek was great. And that was the extent of sci-fi. And but I mean, I got to like sci-fi very much from 2001, and it was just my favorite film for years and years and years. Then Blade Runner came along, and you know, that kind of knocked it out. Star Wars, but I'm like, still, it's on the top, and you know, and it still has a place in my heart because, once again, I was very young and impressionable, and I carry great memories. And I've seen it since I saw it in movie theater.
2001 is his Phantom Menace.
Yeah, but 2001 is a great movie. That's the difference.
It's wrong.
Yes.
Eventually we should probably press play, but I'm trying to think, you know, is there any kind of analog to nowadays to when a 2001 comes out? Because, you know, or a Star Wars comes out. You know, when a movie comes out, like Avatar. 2001, you know, it's a thing. It's a nationwide, not everyone goes to see it, not everyone enjoys it when they do, but everyone knows about it.
Avatar, yeah.
You know, it's like, is Avatar going to change anything fundamentally, or
depends on who you ask.
Well,
Jim would say, yeah.
Actually, I'd say Matrix, probably.
Matrix.
Avatar, I'm not sure if Avatar has done it. Well, I guess maybe it has.
Tone of your criteria, but what you said.
We'll find out. I think those are fair. I think those are the only examples that probably would be.
I think
worth.
Matrix is a really
Matrix
good
and
one.
Avatar, we'll see what kind of lasting effect. But
don't
Matrix,
forget about
think,
Surrogates.
Yeah. Sure, and Surrogates.
Surrogates changed everything.
Yeah.
That being said, get your mouse and remote ready. Go ahead and press play when I say unpause. Here we go. 3, 2, 1, unpause.
Now this
that was a great 3 minutes of music, wasn't it?
It was.
What's awesome. With the music? I mean,
it was an overture.
You guys just explained it to me, but I didn't know. And
yeah,
I always anticipate that our audience is ignorant as I am.
Back in the old days, there, Teague.
If you watch a number of movies, if they've released a full version on video, and sometimes on television, they'll do this too.
I want to bring this up. Actually, this is awesome.
Sure, I'll just
image.
Stop talking.
Sorry.
It's like looking at a snowman from his feet.
Yeah. I know, but you'll get used to it, Trey. You just do it a few times, you'll get used to it.
Okay. This is under the music, but there's a theme that pops up here visually of the alignment of the sun, the moon, and the planets, whether it's the Earth and the moon or whether it's with Jupiter, which comes up later.
Yeah, the alignment is one of the things that the movie says. Without having a scientist go, oh, so when the planets align, then that means something's about to happen. It's a visual motif.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say, and I think I do have a moment, because we're going to watch these planets align almost at planetary speed for a while.
Which is thousands of miles an hour.
Nice flare.
A movie in the 60s, and we're trying to be the anti-television, which meant we have big screens. We have this thing called widescreen we've invented. Don't stay home and watch television. Come to the movies and have a full theatrical experience that you can't get at home. So often big epic blockbuster movies of the 60s especially have an overture, as if you were going to see a theater show, as if you were going to see a Broadway show. Well, it's not playing when you get there, because that means you have to sit down in 3 minutes. It literally, the lights go down and there is an overture, just like there is in a Broadway play. You sat there in the dark while the music played. And then, you know, that's the intro to the film. And if you see a full release of a movie like Ben-Hur or another big blockbuster, Gone with the Wind, you know, it'll say intermission. And it's really actually mostly for television purposes that they put that slug on them often that say intermission or on track overture. So you won't sit there and, you know, be pissed at your television cable network for having the picture not work. Because it's like, no, there's not supposed to be any picture yet. It's black for 30 minutes. It's for 30 seconds. It's the overture. And then smash cut to the African plane.
Right. Now, this takes place, basically, what Kubrick said about 4 million years ago.
There's a title card that says that, right?
It's Dawn of Man. Yeah. But it's not specific about the time.
It was good that they didn't pin it down, because we keep changing when that was anyway.
Are there any points that are specifically different from the book, or does he ever take any weird liberties?
The book is written from the screenplay.
There's
no
this
book.
This is actually one of the... A lot of times movies are based off of book source material, but this is one of the few instances, the only instance I know of, where the book and the movie were essentially written and made at the same time. And they went back...
Whose idea was it?
Kubrick went to Clark and said... Because Clark had written a short story called The Sentinel, which is basically the moon segment of 2001 Space Odyssey, where they're on the moon and they find the monolith and the monolith crazy shit happens. And Kubrick went to Clark and said, I like this. I think there's possibilities for a movie here. Can we flesh this out? So they fleshed out the stories together, and they essentially wrote the screenplay, made the movie, and Clark wrote the book at the same time. And so they're largely similar, because they would go back and forth between the two, but there are still some differences. In the book, they go to Saturn as opposed to Jupiter.
Yeah. Now, a lot of the talk about visual storytelling now is we're going to reduce. It's going to be 45 minutes or so before a spoken word happens in this movie.
That's what we're for.
But this is something that I didn't get until, I read the making of and so on. But it's all being shown what's going on. But here's the problem. The issue is that these proto-humans, which is also, by the way, an amazing makeup job by Stuart Freeborn, who some years later would make a little thing called a Wookiee, and you can actually see the underpinnings of Chewie in these apes. You can see that Chewie technology was being formed with these apes. But the message here is the apes are vegetarians. They coexist with the tapir, and they're starving.
Oh, mm-hmm.
They don't know to eat meat. They haven't figured that out yet, and they haven't figured out how to use tools to kill the meat with. So the breakthrough that they're going to make is let's kill these things that live with us and eat them, and then we'll have food. And the theory is that's
original sin.
Yeah, well, the theory is that's why we exist. Yeah, otherwise we would have died out at the quote unquote dawn of man.
Right.
This, by the way, is a stage set.
Yep. All that is.
Oh, whoa.
Yep.
Yeah. Do they actually have a? That's, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there a leopard attacking that guy?
Yeah. 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 There's a guy in an ape suit being thrashed by a leopard.
Yep.
They actually photographed that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was not from a computer.
Yeah. Welcome to showbiz.
Right. Now.
But that is that set, which they come to back to many times, is that's a transparency in the background. You can just kind of tell because of the color difference. Mm. But that's a gigantic set, and then there's transparencies in the background.
We'll also have a great footprint in the snow moment coming up eventually. Because all of these are obviously dancers performers.
Very, very thin people, so they don't look like people in ape suits.
Right. But eventually they'll have a couple of baby apes, which are real baby apes.
They're a real thing, yeah.
Among them.
But look at these. I mean, this is a tribe of Wookiees. I mean, again, Stuart Freeborn, just a couple years later, would make Chewie, Chewbacca, and everything else for Star Wars. And so you can sort of see he was working it out.
Right. Actually, here with the transparencies in the back, Kubrick developed the front projection system. Which where they had a beaded curtain, and what they did is they had the contraption. We have a half-silvered mirror in front of the camera, and you project the image into it and it reflects onto it.
Oh.
So this is on a stage. You can kind of see where it is. But
you
they
can
went
see
to
the
Africa
divide, but it's pretty darn good.
Oh, yeah. They went to Africa, got all the transparencies.
Who was Kubrick by this point?
He was Kubrick.
He was big. He'd already done Dr. Strangelove, which was his previous film, I guess.
Yes.
64, yeah. Something like that.
Yeah.
Lolita, of course, which is a big thing. And had...
I like Lolita.
Already done Spartacus.
Spartacus was his first full thing.
Yeah.
But he was... On Spartacus, somebody else was fired. I forget who.
Yeah.
And he was brought in to replace that person.
Spartacus is only sort of halfway a Kubrick film.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's kind of an odd choice for that movie. But but also Paths of Glory, which was a critical success. And
excuse me. Does this have any major impact on his career? Is this like the thing
this is where most people finally became aware of Stanley Kubrick, as opposed to I saw a movie called Spartacus, it was pretty cool, I don't know who made it, you know, it's like, because I don't care about those things, but
right on.
But you were at the time, certainly you were very much associated 2001 with Stanley Kubrick. I mean, it's like the names were they went together. It wasn't just the movie, it was the guy who made it was just as well known.
I don't know how this differs, and I guess I could probably figure this out, from Lolita and Clockwork Orange, and to a much lesser degree, Dr. Strangelove. But those three films are my favorite Kubrick films, in that order. And I think Lolita is the most... I haven't seen Barry Lyndon, but it's... Of the ones that I'm aware of, it's the most... There's a movie happening in front of my eyes, not a thing happening in front of my eyes. And Clockwork Orange is just so...
That's a painted. That's a painted dead horse, by the way. and they had to force the leopard to sit next to it because it stank. There's a fun fact from the making of. Go ahead, sorry.
Whoa! I'm just so weirded out by the leopard's eyes that keep glowing.
Yeah,
which was an accident, by the way,
and that was probably because of the front projection. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
It
amplifies that,
and did it with the other animals also. You can see that.
Sorry, so you were making a point. I'm sorry, you're talking about Kubrick and Lolita.
I was going to say that Lolita has something of a story and some character shit going on. Clockwork Orange is so weirdly and perversely compelling that you kind of have to watch it. And Dr. Strangelove is so hysterically funny that you have to watch that. And the rest of them, Full Metal Jacket and this and the rest of them, AI, Eyes Wide Shut, they all have that Kubrick smell to them. AI, of course, has a Spielberg smell to it too. And it doesn't work for me. And I don't know what the difference is. I haven't looked at them critically recently.
Yeah, I mean, you look at this and here they are. They're just...
Yeah,
they're very pacifistic. They're waiting. They're afraid of nature. They're hiding.
And they don't have anything to do. They're just like, well, so we got these thumbs.
This is like Sun Valley.
Anyone got any idea what to do with these thumbs? I don't know.
There's baby
a real
apes.
Chimp baby.
A real chimp.
Yep.
That chimp baby spent the rest of its life fucked up.
Yeah. Now, you look at this. This makeup is awesome. And this was the same year as Planet of the Apes.
Yeah. And this was not nominated.
No. It wasn't nominated.
It wasn't nominated because, as people have said, that it may not have been clear to the nomination people that these are actors, that these aren't apes.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
I mean, Planet of the Apes, we know who Roddy McDowall is.
Yeah, Planet of the Apes was John Chambers won a special award for for makeup for that.
So, yeah, look at the way the face articulates. That's exactly the way Chewie's lips, when it's tied to the jaw. The lips go when the jaw opens. Mm-hmm. And so Chewie's just a refinement of these guys.
Yeah, I think
that would be a stoned actor playing an agent.
Well, he's just waking up.
Yeah, I think he's called Moonwatcher in the book.
Yeah, that's him.
You can see his little...
Yeah. Oh, okay. He's excited about something. Yeah,
all right, so this is our monolith, right?
The monolith.
Yes.
All right, guys.
Which, first of all, just if you want to get geeky, its dimensions are 1 by 3 by 9,
yes.
The prime squared.
Okay, cool.
And it's solid black, nothing to it.
Yeah. Go ahead and panel this one out for me. I'm going to table this. What does this mean, and why is it here?
Well, the
guys who know this movie,
there's two things about this movie. One is, again, when you're first watching this movie, you know, it doesn't come with the crib notes, and it doesn't come with the guy in the white coat going, now we understand. You know, you're supposed to experience it, and that's why people interpret it, this is all kinds of things. I mean, you could say this is God, you know, this is God's way of doing things. The literal intention of the filmmakers, we just jump and look behind the curtain, the literal intention is aliens, you know, some intelligence that isn't us, clearly, because we don't have any yet.
It doesn't look 1 by 3 by 9. It looks skinnier than one. Go on.
It could be. Mm-hmm. Or it's 1 by 1 by what is it? 1 by 1 by 4 by 9. Pardon me.
Oh,
it's 1 squared, 2 squared, 3 squared.
There you go.
Okay.
Aliens.
Thank you. So some intelligence has placed this here, and as you'll see, you know, again, it's all in pantomime. But he, you know, the Moonwatcher is the one who finally touches it, and from it gains this understanding of tools and weapons, which allows us to advance. Jumping ahead in the story, the monolith or another monolith just like it is buried on the moon. The idea being, if this species can advance far enough to get to the moon and find the monolith, they'll dig it up, and the sunlight will hit it, and that will send us a signal that says, they made it to the moon, go talk to them. So this is basically giving us our shot at having a civilization, is what this device is doing.
Right, exactly. And the sun, and I mean, here they've hesitated, and now they're up on it, and just waiting for the moment when...
And this is where not having the music... It takes more than 50% of the experience away.
Yeah.
Music just creeps the hell out of you.
Yeah, that's the Ligeti, and which comes back later.
Yeah, yeah, I always enjoyed the fact that
there is.
Yeah, that there's the alignment,
and it's the sun touching the monolith, and that's what gives them essentially the knowledge.
It's when the monolith gets hit by.
It's funny that
you'll also notice, and again, the movie doesn't make a big deal out of it, but they live with the monolith for a while, and then one day it's gone. It's not there anymore. It just went away in the middle of the night. So anyway, go ahead.
It's funny that you guys, as fans, say you're losing some of the experience by not hearing the weird ambient music. I'm enjoying this way more because I'm giving it credit where credit's may or may not be. You know, I'm giving it credit that there's excess sound design and something that I can connect with in a movie that I'm only seeing pictures. I'm not hearing the audio like we always do. I always just infer that there's sound that I can connect to going on. If it was just a piece of music, that's the driving force.
There's a wonderful bit of pantomime right here. And it plays almost a lot in long shot. But this is a great bit of pantomime of him getting this idea,
and this is also to the Strauss, to Zarathustra, playing.
And this is just one of the most famous 30 seconds or a minute in film there is.
It totally has been parodied 8 million different ways.
Yeah.
Well, actually, what you're thinking of comes in a little bit. This is the precursor to that.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. Actually, yeah.
There are some
for those that aren't watching the movie along with us.
Yeah,
he's looking at bones and going, oh shit,
what can I do here?
The fact that it takes, you know, they're really playing this out, you know, because he sees this one that's like, huh, that's, I could put my hand on that end.
Yeah.
And, huh, look what it does. So it's just a great, it's playing out in one. It's all playing out in one shot.
Which the idea.
Ow.
Oops.
He's okay. Oh, was it for tools.
Yeah. He's like, oh, and there was no civilization. Hit me in the eye, and that was it.
Which the idea being behind this idea, this concept, is the fact that human beings are special because we're the only animals that use tools, which at this point
is not,
we've learned that is not true.
It's not, but we're certainly the only ones who develop them. That's the difference.
Yeah.
But yeah, other animals have thumbs. Plenty of animals are faster than us. Plenty are almost as smart as us.
Well, the thing that weirded me out was
being smart isn't necessarily a good thing because we're smart, but not much else. You know, anything else can kill us.
It's not even so much like we're smart, but that's not a great thing. But it's like how not much smarter we are than other animals.
Yeah.
We're learning more and more about how smart chimpanzees and other apes really are, and exactly how smart dolphins and other aquatic mammals are. the thing that blew my mind was that not only do other primates use tools, like we know chimpanzees and other primates do, but dolphins use tools.
Yeah.
Right. And that blew my mind.
The air bubble curtain is amazing.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
Right. But in a way, I mean, we've been the ones who've been able to take essentially technology much further than any other species.
We can build tools. I mean, chimps will use things as tools, but they're not going, if I make a screwdriver, then I can make a TRS-100. That's awesome.
We're the only species that makes tools to build other tools.
So anyway, right. so here you see the differences. You know, they've got, hey, meat, awesome.
Yep.
You know, the idea that, you know, overnight you can become a carnivorous species, you know, an anthropologist might have a problem with that. But
I mean, you'll notice even before they're eating meat, they have incisors.
Yeah. So clearly it just hadn't occurred to them. You know, like, we used to do it, but now we forgot.
And then where this leads...
Which is possible. It can't happen in the species.
Yeah. And then where this leads, of course, is what that allows them to do to essentially become dominant in the species.
Yeah. Because they're going to have their little war now where they're, you know, the tribe that was scary last time is like, all right, now we got the bomb, my friend. So.
Yeah.
We cannot allow North Korea to get bone technology.
That's right. We will bury you.
You want some?
You people are going to be the precursors of France.
Hey, watch it.
We are German apes. Ah, we have big bone. So. Great, it's always great, you know, great pantomime. And, you know, the fact that these people all went to, you know, ape pantomime school and this whole thing. I mean, you can obviously these are people in suits, but their pantomime is pretty good.
And here he comes across like, am I gonna do it? Come on. Will this work?
It works on pigs. Yeah. I'm gonna give it a go. Don't push me, man. I got a thing here that you won't believe what happens.
And
this isn't about sex, this is about power.
Yeah.
And another one. It's like, okay. And
so this is
that's it. Hey,
so yeah, their behavior is great. It's like, I don't know if this is going to work or not, but I'm going
to
try.
But now I'm doing it. I don't know. You know how dead you need to be dead. So we're just going to keep doing it just to demonstrate. So and there,
apes understand the idea of if it's a pulp,
it's probably dead.
And now it's like, see,
mess with that. You want a piece of this? Yeah. How about you? Short face. You want a piece of this?
That's right. This is our water hole now.
Yeah.
Get out.
Yeah.
Goo.
Go evolve into Neanderthals. Why don't you?
Right. And here it comes. Now comes the shot.
What's the
This is the shot.
Cut.
Here it is.
It always, even at the time, it always perturbed me. Boom. That it's not a straight cut. You expect it to be like a perfect cut, right. And it's not.
It goes up, and then it comes back down.
But I'm just saying it doesn't match. I mean, it's like you would expect it to like be lined up when it cuts. It doesn't.
I still love Ray Lovejoy.
I don't understand I've never seen that shot before, or a parody of it.
Oh, really?
To my knowledge.
What's
the significance of it? Well, I've seen in Zoolander where they go apeshit when they start beating on a computer.
What's the significance of the shot? The shot is, and now look at the tools we make.
Right.
Yeah. It's a match cut. It's like, here's the bone. The bone is a tool. We'll throw it up. The bone gets replaced by a satellite, which is just a more sophisticated tool. Yeah. In the book, actually, and in the script, that's supposed to be a nuclear weapons satellite, like a nuclear weapons platform, which continues the theme of tools for good or evil.
The first tool is used as a weapon. That's what it's for.
All right, guys, who read this book a million times. How are they doing this? Are these a bunch of still images?
Yes, often. Yeah, this glass—it's what's called a glass shot. Many times, where literally the planet's painted on a piece of glass, so you can light it up from behind and light it up.
Are they moving it frame by frame, or are they just sliding it smoothly?
Combinations.
There was some very, very basic. Well, it's a multiplane camera, isn't it? I mean, they're basically using multiplane, just glorified multiplane.
Okay, well, that's clearly a model.
Yes.
And a really nice model.
I guess the best summary is: what innovations did they come up with?
I'm not sure if there's any innovation.
Yeah. Sarah's like, Trey.
I'm not sure if there's innovations in this. There's just a more sophisticated use of a lot of existing technology. What I was about to say is I think there's a lot of, like, for example, Disney invented the multiplane camera in the 30s to do Snow White and other movies like that, where they said, first of all, you know, we'll paint on glass.
Damn, that looks great.
Yeah.
It looks really cool.
Because the multiplane camera that Disney. Pan-American and Bell Telephone is what dates this movie more than anything else. But a multiplane camera, and you can see it in classic era Disney films, is, you know, they said, okay, we'll paint on glass because the animation is a flat sheet of paper, of plastic or glass. But what if we had multiple layers of glass with different paintings on them, and then as we moved across it, we would create parallax? So that's how. So it's called a multiplane glass camera, and that's why those classic movies were like, that was a breakthrough for cartoons. It's like they have a 3D feel because the backgrounds
are back there.
Move in three dimensions, and you don't have to calculate it. You just build a three-dimensional layout and do it that way.
So is this just an optical layover?
No, that was a plane of glass.
And it's on a thread right there.
Yeah, and in fact, it's moving non-ballistically. Maybe that's the wrong word, but that's not how something would orbit. Like, it would orbit its own center of gravity. It can't orbit in a circle like that. It's one of the few technical mistakes in the movie.
Right.
For the longest time when I was a kid, this is the first time I was aware of this thing called Velcro, too. But for the longest time, I thought when she does the great walk around up the circle and they said she's wearing Velcro shoes, I thought that's how they did the effect, was that she was wearing Velcro shoes.
And she has incredibly strong ankles?
Yeah, apparently so. So
I'm very happy, and not like on a technical level, but on a audience level, with the depiction of the future, even 40 years ago, 50 years ago almost.
This movie is older than us actually walking on the moon.
Yeah.
And it still looks incredible.
Well, it looks plausible. It looks like, that's comfortable. That's a good shot. That seems like a realistic ship.
If you saw the way his arm kind of floated
a little
bit.
Yeah, he was doing a nice pantomime there.
Yeah.
I'd also like to point out
they got the details right. And most
these
movies
make so much more sense than the freaking Enterprise do.
Yeah. Now, an important thing. Most movies of this era did not even care about the details because, you know.
Nobody knew the details.
Yeah, space travel wasn't, you know, a reality for humans. You know, it was like this crazy sci-fi idea.
Right. Now, one thing we're missing here because we don't have the sound is, of course, the Blue Danube, which at the time was quite revolutionary because you had a certain, essentially, people who were older would associate the Blue Danube with, you know, whatever, Vienna and that kind of thing.
And a science fiction movie, you had to get a theremin.
Right, exactly.
The only way you scored a science fiction movie was to do spacey music. You know, you would have like weird, you know, weird, whatever you could do that sounded spacey and weird. And for him to do this very elaborate space scene to a classical piece of music was revolutionary also.
Right. Now, here's a question for you guys. Is this the
visualization? That's awesome.
Yeah, isn't it good? And the panel design still looks plausible even today. Yeah.
It's better than the original Star Trek's panel design.
Oh, by leaps and bounds. Yeah. Is this the first science fiction film or first instance of science fiction in popular culture that portrayed science fiction with some amount of class, with some amount of culture to it, as opposed to being, you know, Star Trek, while great, is not very highbrow.
Jimmy Jones, Rocket Ranger.
Exactly.
Whatever,
Flash Gordon style.
Right. Wagon Train to the Stars.
Look at that little comp in there.
Little RP going on.
And look at the comp on top.
And one on the right
down.
And left.
Yeah.
And that's all.
Is it just RP?
I think that's front projection.
It's probably front projection. Looks a little washed out, so it's probably front projection.
Yeah. But, now, the interesting thing here is you have the shot. I mean, you've got the station, and you've got the stars going around, and then how the clipper actually starts rotating with the station to come in.
And then they cut to now they're going to do the POV shot where, to them, the station is now stationary, and it docks. So it is. So to answer your question, like, very few movies would actually, or television shows certainly, would go to this level of detail to kind of demonstrate this is the process of how this could work and make a whole sequence out of it that isn't an action sequence or anything
else. Actually fascinated this time. I don't know what's changed.
Yeah, there you go.
Maybe it's that I just care now.
Now, let's skip forward actually about a decade to Star Trek The Motion Picture, which tried to emulate this experience when Scotty takes Kirk around the Enterprise, which to a certain extent when you saw it in the theater worked. I mean, it tends to be a little long, but it did have its emotional value when you know, if you're coming back to Star Trek.
Yeah, for Star Trek fans who were fans of the original show, which had then been canceled, and then 10 years went by, and go, I finally get to see the Enterprise again.
On a big screen, and really show it off.
And this fantastic model,
It had a film predecessor, and here comes
the first dialogue.
25 minutes in, 25 minutes and 40 seconds.
So what's the...
This shot, by the way, is replicated in The Incredibles.
That's right. The Incredibles is very suffused with 2001.
Heywood Floyd.
Is the... Heywood Floyd... I would look at what we just saw as being, for the purposes of the next 40 years of model work, photoreal spaceship stuff, right? Was this the first really good example of photoreal spaceship stuff, or did that exist before?
Well, there was great model work, you know. It wasn't like they invented great model work right for this movie, but it's
that looks as good as Star Wars, as good as
it's one of the earliest examples of people just taking it seriously in terms of the movie they were putting it in. I mean, you know, Forbidden Planet has good model work too, you know, from 10 years earlier. But this was good model work and plausible model work, you know, it where they actually had advisors who said, well, you know, this is what it probably would look like. You know, at least by this time we were building things that went into space. So there was a certain look that people were starting to become familiar with about what a thing that travels in space looks like.
So do we have any understanding of what Kubrick was, what he wanted to do? What was going on in his brain? Was he a space nerd? Did he want to tell a story about the horror of space?
Kubrick's thing was he basically wanted to go through and conquer each genre that he did. And this was his, I want to make the science fiction film. So he sat down and made 2001 Space Odyssey.
I'm impressed that they built this Kirby set just for that feel.
And it's really, really long. What really strikes me about this is this reminds me so much of, I guess, I guess, architectural designs from the late 60s and how they saw the future. Yeah. But now,
let's be honest. You could walk into many agents' offices in Hollywood and find those exact chairs.
That's true.
And find the style.
Yes. I mean,
it has a very airport feel to it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but that's the whole thing. I think it all fed on itself, what airports were looking like. I mean, especially if you look at the design of Dulles Airport and what they had done there.
Well, the other thing is it was what, for these sequences, he very much wanted it to demonstrate this, like, not only is this what space travel is like, it's like this is where space travel has become already by this point a commercial business, right, and is actually commonplace and mundane. You know, the fact that there's a Howard Johnson's Earthlight room, and you know, here's your picture phone station, and when you're sitting in the theater, and it's probably in the soundtrack, but it maybe in 5.1 you get the effect, but also because this was in a theater, is like, you know, big multiphonic stereo, which is also, you know, fairly new at the time. As there that shot of them walking down the curvature of the station there, there's an announcement. There's a woman going, "A woman's sweater has been found," and it's not mixed out of the front speakers. It's mixed to the side or the rears if you have that kind of a mix, where it literally comes across like who's making an announcement during the movie about, you know, "I don't care about a sweater, I'm watching a movie." And the idea is like, you know, this is space travel at this point. It's like, yeah, well, I'm gonna call my daughter and then I'll meet you for lunch in the Howard Johnson's, and you know, it's not mystical. It's all very mundane.
Well, exactly. It's become mundane. It's become regular. It's the Hilton. If you saw there, it's the Hilton space station.
Yeah.
And
it's the Hilton space station.
Yeah.
It seems like you can count the stepstones from Forbidden Planet to 2001 to Star Wars to Alien in terms of we're getting more and more and more lived in.
Yeah.
We're going
yeah.
from, you know, the pristine.
Logan's Run.
Sci-fi.
Or Buck Rogers.
Logan's Run is the opposite.
Yeah, right.
Well, you're starting there. And you get to the point where it seems like every major visionary leap forward in sci-fi filmmaking, oh, it feels so lived in. Well, every single one was way more lived in than the last one. Yeah. That seems like it's the default idea.
Wow, $1.70 is a good deal.
That's pretty cheap.
By the way, I don't think we mentioned, but that's Kubrick's daughter who was playing that little girl.
Yeah.
Vivian is her name, I think.
Yeah, so we can talk a lot about what this movie got right about the future and what it got wrong. Obviously, Pan Am and Bell Telephone.
How about the whole centrifugal thing?
Yeah, centrifugal.
That's dead on.
Centripetal.
Centrifugal.
Yeah.
Right.
That's
centrifugal is actually an imaginary force.
Centripetal.
Yeah, centripetal.
It's actually a centripetal force.
Right. Right.
Don't ask me to explain what the difference is. I know. I'm just saying.
Does the centripetal thing work?
Yes, yeah. It does work.
And this was certainly one of the first, I mean, I think maybe some, you know, 1950s Man to the Moon, you know, kind of movies might have attempted it. But most science fiction movies and television shows just kind of skate over the whole gravity problem. You know, even beloved ones where, you know, it's kind of their magic beam. It's like
Firefly.
How does Firefly have gravity? Exactly. Never
Star
mind.
Trek.
We don't talk
about
it.
And what about when you turn on the air and all, or when you lock out the vacuum and all of a sudden, boom, oh, good, gravity.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, we don't talk about that. This movie, you know, committed. They, you know, there's only gravity when there's either a gizmo like this. Discovery has one built into it, and everywhere else you go is gravity, or when you're on the moon, it's only moon gravity.
So. But there are minor quibbles even so. And
there's some mistakes, not to nitpick.
Yeah.
His trip to the moon has one that people like to point to. Although I can excuse it.
Well, unfortunately, it's a production problem that nobody has really figured out, and I wouldn't even know how. But how to replicate moon or Mars gravity, which is lighter. So if you were on the moon, you would move at a difference. And if you watch the astronauts on the moon, they bounce because the gravity is less.
Earth to the moon did it.
Earth to the moon did it, but they did it with the exterior moonwalk. And how would you replicate that effect on an interior soundstage on a set inside the moon?
It's hard to crack.
Inside a moon base. Which my favorite... I don't know if you guys ever saw the Sherlock Holmes cartoon where he ended up in the future.
Wow.
One of my favorite
inconsistencies. I have to say no to that one.
One of my favorite inconsistencies.
You lost me with Sherlock Holmes cartoon.
Yeah. Well, for some reason, it was in the future. Don't ask me why. But there was an episode where he was on the moon. And this was probably the only episode I saw, just to make that clear. But my favorite part of that was the fact that when they were on the surface in spacesuits, they would bounce around like they were on the moon. And then they would go inside and it would
be normal gravity. Well, they would do that on Space 1999 as well. This is, what's it, Leonard Rossiter? Is that actor's name?
Russian? I don't know. The interesting thing is they're all Russians here. Remember, this is 1968. This is, you know, Cold War was going on. And here they're presenting a future where the Russians and the Americans can friendlily be up in space in 2001.
There's still
the tension.
They're pushing each other for information.
And they've come in here to this very nice...
But the idea that they would even talk to each other at this point, and obviously they would have no idea in 1968 that the Soviet Union would be 10 years gone by then, but
this is typical. This is actually how it was. I mean, you know, it's like Soviets and, you know, the Soviet people and the American people didn't necessarily hate each other. It was our governments who were having a problem. You know, right. Soviets are, you know, just they wanted to sit down and have a vodka
that
with you.
Effed up me.
Yeah, it does. Look at that thing. But yeah. But this is exactly kind of how the dynamic was. Like, you know, scientists would meet at a conference and then very carefully dance around what they could or couldn't say to each other about whatever they were doing.
Right.
And then one guy would go, I'd like to defect.
take me with you.
Take me to your boss. That's but right. Anyway, so this scene is about how, you know, there's Clavius base and Clavius has been suddenly declared off limits. And that's where Floyd's headed. And the Russians are asking, well, what's going on at Clavius? Don't we need to know? Isn't there something that we should know? And he's like, well, I really just can't say.
Right. So. And they ask him, I think, is there some kind of bug going around or something?
Virus. Yeah.
A virus, yeah. Exactly.
Which is actually the counterintelligence story that they've leaked.
Right.
That there's a disease at Clavius Base. One of Kubrick's pet peeves about this movie, or Clark's, or both, was that people would see this movie and then talk about how, and then Floyd goes to planet Clavius, because, you know, it's like just because they kept calling it Clavius, and you know, and he goes, why do we have all those shots of the moon? I don't understand. Why do we bother having him like travel across the moon? Right.
You
to
know,
go to
watching watching this, now I get why Star Wars became Star Wars.
Yeah. Right.
Star Wars is a ride compared to this shit.
Yeah, it's the anti.
And it's
the anti.
It's beautiful, and it's.
Well, it stood really, on. It's. I mean, it's, Star Wars stood on this film's shoulders, definitely.
Yeah. I'm sure we would have not had Star Wars without this. Well, maybe. I don't know. He was coming from the serials, not from this. But I'm sure this influenced it in many weird and conscious and subconscious ways. But I can understand how people would see this and being all, oh, 2001, and then Star Wars comes out and they're like, fuck yeah. Like, I can understand how that change would happen.
Well, when Star Wars came out, it was a different experience than this.
They're flying to the moon, and they're choosing to watch a karate match instead.
The thing you're missing is the people who saw this movie were the ones who made Star Wars when they got older. You know, George Lucas saw this movie when he was, you know, early 20s, if so. He was probably in film school, I guess. Was he in film school early, late 60s?
Yeah.
Early, mid 60s?
I think he was USC by now.
Yeah, but, you know, but this is the kind of movie that, you know, Lucas and a million others like him, kids raised on television and serials, and then seeing that, you know, this in a movie theater, going, well, that's pretty awesome too. What if I kind of combine all the stuff I'm into, and I'll make something called Star Wars out of it?
Right. I mean, actually, let's bring this up. That at the time, I mean, there was, you know, the kids, but the students, but also there was a lot of drug taking in the '60s, and part of it was to do some drugs and then go see this movie. This became known as like you want to take a trip.
This was a trip movie for sure.
Yeah, totally trip movie.
Easy Rider and this.
Now, how much of this was influenced by the space race? And at the time, that was right coming to a head.
Can you guys explain to me how this shot works? I still have no idea.
The set rotates.
It's rotating, man.
And
camera's fixed.
And she's standing on the, you can't see it because it's cleverly built, but she's just standing on a black circle that goes all the way around. And they're just
the whole set's rotating.
And that part you don't see rotating, but it's actually not rotating.
If you were in space, you would just disconnect from the floor.
Well, she's wearing the Velcro shoes.
Yeah.
So she's just jump off.
She's going to help you out. Turn the camera around.
They flip her around. But and her pantomime is pretty good. But what's nice about the way they did it, though, is that's done as a one-er.
And Straker.
That's there you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cameo by Ed. Ed Bishop.
Ed Bishop.
Who went on to play just a few years later, very few years later, play Straker on a great series called UFO, which a lot of the effects people worked on. Anyway, here's one of these so-called technical mistakes: is the juice goes back down when he stops sucking on it.
Go to hell!
Yeah, it's you know, this is what geeks even in 67 we had geeks who would complain about.
There he is.
There is a little cameo, and actually this is all done with music. You know, there was chit chat.
Oh, love this!
There was chit chat, but they have a conversation, but they just put music over it. And that was Kubrick's decision: is, you know, nothing that any of these characters are saying matters, so I'm just going to put music over it all.
In this book, actually, in the making of Kubrick's 2001, are the instructions,
the complete instructions
for
the zero gravity toilet, the actual text of what that says, yeah. It's actually pretty funny.
You can contribute. I'll look at the book.
The zero gravity toilet is literally the one intentional joke in the movie. Is the zero gravity toilet cutaway?
Oh, here it is. There it is.
Yeah.
Ooh.
look at this photo of the moon.
It's great.
Yeah.
Again, people, this was in the theaters a year before we actually walked on the freaking thing.
Pretty. Right.
Yeah. I mean, they'd done several missions in a couple of years to go around.
We had orbited the moon at this point, and we had, you know, unmanned landers and unmanned orbiters that take took high-res photos.
I remember as a kid, I was just, I think I had my first boner because of the way this thing's legs
look
deployed.
I mean, once again, this was in the middle of the space race, and we hadn't gone to the moon, and this was actually saying, well, we've gone to the moon, and we're there, and it really captured the imagination
it works,
of it. Yeah.
This is how we do it.
And, well, now we go to the moon regularly.
Yeah, all the time.
Which, unfortunately, didn't happen.
We don't do so much, but... So they're using every trick in the book here. There's flat photography that's just being animated on multiplane. There's a little RP going on. So that's like a photo. You can see the perspective isn't quite changing on the ship. But, you know, they're using various different tricks. They're mixing it up. They're keeping it interesting. And
I'm reading the Zero Gravity thing right now. They are, by the way, classified as, System A and System B.
Yes.
Depending on what it is you need to do.
Important.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there would be a System C, but I guess they've got people for that. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe so.
And this is still to the Blue Danube.
Yep.
They just continue.
You may leave the lavatory if the green exit light is on over the door. If the red light is illuminated, one of the lavatory facilities is not properly secured.
That's important.
Oh, this is embarrassing. Press stewardess called button on the right door.
Yeah, you don't want to have to
and
do
she
that.
Will secure the facilities from the outside.
That's why you should read. Now, it's funny that they're...
Make sure it's all gone before you do this.
This moon base design is almost exactly what Moon Base Alpha from Space 1999 a few years later ended up looking like.
In fact,
it also looks like the thing in Contact.
Yep.
Clavius Base, also the name of Tom Hanks' production company.
Yeah.
Because 2001 is his favorite movie as well.
And 2001.
God, you guys are all nerds.
He's a wise man.
Tom Hanks is awesome.
Is the Independence Day thing based on this design where it's just the triangles that kind of separate out away from each other? Because that's what it looks like when the big ship opens up its primary weapon.
Everything comes from 2001.
Because it's cool.
Except for Surrogates, which ripped off heavily.
Yeah, totally.
Right.
I remember even at the time, I thought, wow, not only are we, you know, having a moon base, but we can have a moon base that has this colossal landing hangar in it. And we've even gone to the trouble of building, like, an astrodome to put on top of it. It's like, wow, we really got this moon thing figured out by this point. But this movie, it was really eye-opening that, like what you were saying, I think it's what you were asking about before, where they were so serious about really, really depicting accurately the processes of this.
MFR, when ready.
Yes, you know that the mm-hmm. yeah, the you know the ship doesn't come in gliding like a plane or anything like that.
That's,
it's like
I like how the not, feet. Look at the feet.
The smoke asset is. It's not saying zero gravity to me.
And as if that's tough. Not enough.
Yeah,
then it's got to come down
this
into
colossal
here.
Chamber that we drop it into.
And then look on the side. Look at all the. The level of detail and thinking through of what this was. And then, but the thing is that it just opened your imagination to this is what we had accomplished in whatever it was from that time, 30 years.
By the way, those who are actually watching this along with us, this was 9 years ago. Wasn't that fun?
Yeah. Remember what that was like? Remember that?
Those were the days.
And this is
the year we made Contact.
This is the year actually that we made Contact and Jupiter's going to explode and become a star.
I hate when that happens.
Yeah. So get ready for that.
Yeah.
So does Jupiter.
Yeah. Hope they're ready.
Yeah.
Hey, these are going to be more like Tatooine now.
Wait, I think they're called Jovians.
Yeah.
Jovians, yes. Jovians. Well, Jovian Americans.
Yeah.
Well, it could be Jovian Canadians, too.
Or American Jovians, if you went. If you emigrated there.
What's funny about this sequence is you kind of expect, because it's especially this long, long, long build, you know, the sequence doesn't end and it doesn't have any kind of like ta-da to it. It's just the music comes to an end. It's an existing classical piece and it just stops and they cut out. It's over. And this, of course, is...
But the music still has that ta-da quality.
Yeah, but the scene doesn't have like a, right. You know, the thing doesn't land. The door on top doesn't finish closing. It just stops when the music stops. This guy with his high-tech futuristic camera, which actually isn't too far off.
That's right.
It's not
bad. I think I've got one like that.
It's not too bad.
That looks kind of like a Scarlet.
Yeah,
actually.
Yeah, or like a flip phone.
So this is, of course, these guys have to wrap this up quickly because Ripley is going to have her hearing in this room in about a half hour. So, you know, because apparently she wrecked a whole starship that was worth $47 million. So,
once again, I hate when that happens.
Yeah. Those are adjusted dollars, of course.
But here in this scene, just to keep people up with the plot, this is him
essentially... I like how they simulate windows.
Yeah,
is that the idea?
Yeah, I think it is, and it's essentially what
the subconscious experience of windows.
Yeah, yeah.
It's also like, well, these are projection screens. We're just not going to project anything on them right now. Maybe that's it too. But yeah, it's just a big old white room, brightly lit room.
But I just love it. This is the moon, and there's rooms just like here on Earth on the moon.
And you've got your water glass and your water pitcher, and
it's just
and
all
your weird
so normal.
Chairs.
Yeah.
But in terms of plot, this is Haywood saying, "Okay, well, sorry about the cover story, which is the virus that we've had to tell everybody, but thanks for all of your cooperation while we deal with this real thing, which is the monolith, which we'll see in a couple minutes." And essentially the scene, correct me if I'm wrong, but this scene is just him going, thanks for your cooperation. Let's go check it out.
And the great thing about this is that here's all this mundanity about the travel to the moon, I mean, to address this very, very seminal, important moment in human history. And what Kubrick's done is he's taken, instead of just trying to have someone explain through it and take care of it in, what, 15, 20 minutes of character development and plot, he's taken you on the trip of this guy to the moon, so you know what his voyage is, because it's that important.
Okay.
Well, what tells us that he's important is he's been alone on all these flights. I mean, they just spent millions of dollars to get this guy to the moon to give this scintillating lecture. One of the great mysteries of the movie is, you know, why is this guy so, because he's going to disappear. He's only going to be in the movie for another 10 minutes, and then he's going to be gone, and we've spent all this time with him, and we're never going to see him again.
Until 2010.
Which is very, he's going to be played by Roy Scheider, but it's, you know, it's very unconventional, again, storytelling to suddenly just wipe the slate clean. Everything we've been watching for 20 minutes doesn't matter except as a setup for the next phase, which is going to be about all different characters.
He's going to the moon to talk to them.
Right.
And the central mystery, the answer is, we found this thing, right?
And to go see it. I mean, yeah. I mean, he isn't. The whole point is he's in charge of this. So this is his thing that he's got to take care of somehow and manage.
All right. So we just found another monolith.
They found something. Yeah,
we don't
know what it is.
We didn't know there was one at the dawn of man. We just found a monolith.
Right. They went digging. We'll see that in a bit.
Because it was a magnetic anomaly, and they dug for it.
I mean, oh, that's
they were
okay,
looking
that's
for
right,
it
yeah.
on purpose. Like, what the hell? Something's under there. I mean, again, it's designed to be that way. So, you know, the alien intelligence said, We'll make it so you'll want to find it if you're capable of looking for it.
If they get to the moon and they know what electromagnetism is,
yeah.
they'll figure it out.
Yeah. They'll get to this point. And then when the sunlight hits it, it'll activate and, you know, send us a message.
Right. The anomaly was called TMA-1.
Yeah.
Tycho, because
it's in Tycho crater.
Tycho-magnetic anomaly 1, yeah. That's right.
So again, this is all—it's all very mundane. It's one of the things that Kubrick was doing with this is that half of what, you know, there's almost no dialogue in this entire movie that's actually means anything at all. That's one of the things that Kubrick was going for is, you know, like there's a scene that's coming up much later. We'll skip ahead, but the idea, you know, Lockwood's discussion with his parents. Is the most boring conversation humans have ever had in the history of mankind, which is about 99% of the conversations humans have had in the history of mankind.
This particular human just happens to be on his way to Jupiter.
Yeah, so the idea is that, you know, it's like this guy's living this amazing, you know, futuristic thing where he's traveling to Jupiter to do this whole thing, and you know, he's like, all right, I'll take my call from my parents, and they go, hey, so...
But why not...
How are you?
...take the extra crazy leap and make it relatable, and make it... We're talking
it
about
is relatable. Well, most of the time people I talk to are boring, and you know.
Well, yeah, but they're also relatable.
It's very.
They're talking in a about interesting things at an interesting.
But
it
I think
is
what,
very
I think
anti-dramatic.
But I think
I had this model, by the way. This is a great model kit. This is an awesome model kit.
I think what it does, I mean, essentially places
the
event
called.
Itself in a bit of a crucible and saying. These are the people who are moving through it, but this is. I mean, this yeah. is a seminal, extremely important event. That's happening,
yeah.
By making everything less important, it focuses you, I mean, in a way, on an unconscious level, on the important event, on what it is, even though you're watching it, and it makes you experience you're watching him go there, and you follow it, and it keeps your interest just enough, but the point is this, it's not really cognitive. It's working on about that the symbol, the whole
it's
importance
on the
of
second
it.
Level.
On the second level, and that's right. The whole thing. The mundanity gets you into it. And here they're going to eat sandwiches.
Well, here's the thing about the
they're
going
to have a whole conversation
here's,
about sandwiches.
Here's the thing to the mundanity in my response to Trey is that 100% of the conversations you'll ever have alive on this planet don't mean anything. That's not the point. Everyone thinks everything they say is really important. I never caught that vibe here.
Well, these guys,
just humans being assholes, always think what's going on in my life right now is the big fucking deal, and I need to convince you.
And whether or not this is chicken salad is important to these characters, yeah. And that's why they talk about it.
Right.
And whether or not it tastes like real chicken salad is, I think, is part of their conversation. Also, I mean, you see some of the amazing moonscapes that they set up here. If you want to see some cool, real moonscapes, some interesting lunar geography, look up some photos from any of the latter Apollo missions, because... The first Apollo missions, they were like, well, we're not sure if we can land at all, so we'll find the flattest spot we can and put down, which is what all Apollo 11 was about, and then Apollo 12 to a lesser extent. Yeah. But as they got through the missions, they were like, okay, we're kind of getting the hang of this, so we'll try landing on that mountaintop up there. Let's give it a try. And so the later missions have much more interesting topography and geography around them. So.
And that's why Swaggart freaked out and blew up the plane. He didn't want to land on a mountain.
Okay. Well, they were actually supposed to land at the Farmore Highlands, which is Apollo 14 landed there instead.
It was all a joke.
So, Highlands.
Now, getting back to the food, actually, I mean, back in the the 60s, the whole thing with the space age, I mean, space age food and everything.
The crust
Tang,
cut off.
Remember Tang when Tang came out? Sure. Tang was the big thing.
Space food sticks.
That's right. You can have the orange juice that the astronauts have. It was a big thing. So
I don't know if you're aware of this. We had a giant, holy shit, we landed on the moon party, where we had a whole lot of fun with it. We all dressed up like Mission Control, and we had Tang Jello shots.
Nice.
That's where that rocket ship in the corner came from. Is I made that so we could hang it in the ceiling.
That
and,
is awesome. Oh, but the whole thing of freeze-dried
food. Food in space.
Well, because back then, modernity, the future was just such a big thing, which kind of started going away by the mid to late 70s, and then definitely by Star Wars, you know, it was gone. And then turned into Blade Runner and dystopias by then. Yeah. But it was definitely the future.
Now,
you
absolutely wanted the space food sticks for your lunchbox, and the fact that they tasted awful made no difference whatsoever, because it was important to have the space food sticks.
Yeah.
Well, now you can buy freeze-dried food and powdered everything at Fry's.
Well, now it's
that's
normal.
True.
Yeah, that's
lol high.
Yeah,
we developed the technology to that point. So
I love how the lunar background is just like floating by.
I had this experience with Full Metal Jacket too.
So much more well thought out than most movies of its time.
And the moving camera, just they didn't leave it static. They're trucking to the left.
Yeah, this is all. There's nothing about the technology that's particularly a breakthrough. It's just a filmmaker got hold of technology and said, "I'm going to make a space movie that feels like this."
Right.
So you were saying about Full Metal Jacket.
The reason I get so agitated with movies, I don't want to say like this, because often there are outliers and often there are some that are even more so. It's just in cases where I get agitated with the movie along these lines or this exact feeling that I have, it has to do with. But why didn't they just do this? And it's not that I don't like to be challenged, because a lot of my favorite movies are deeply challenging movies that everyone hates. It's that I don't understand Stanley Kubrick at all. And it's not that I can't understand the words, or when you put it on paper and you go, here's what he's doing, man, lol. Here you go, man, take this. I get that. But I don't understand why he chose to do that as opposed to anything else. And that will never be an answer I have, and I can't ever reconcile it. And it just makes me grind my gears trying to figure out what's going on here that I'm missing, because I don't connect to this in a way that a lot of people seem to, and I wish I did.
I think
I can't put it into words. I can't figure out what it is.
I think it goes back to what we were talking about before. Kubrick is not so much about the story, although he is trying to tell a story, and he does tell a story here. But it's about the experience, the visceral quality of it. And, I mean, obviously I'm too young to have seen this in the theater, but just not too long after I moved out here in the first place, I was fortunate enough they were playing the 70mm print of this at the Egyptian, and even this has been my favorite movie for years, and I haven't seen it on a screen larger than this, you know, in all that time. I was able to go down and watch 2001 in the Egyptian, you know, spread out before me the way it's really meant to be. And
that is a badass matte painting.
It is. It really is.
And it's an in-camera, of course. It's a glass shot, so that's a set, but then that's a glass shot. Notice how they don't cross.
Right. And the pit is actually 60 feet across by 120 deep by 60 feet down. Yeah. That's the whole set.
It's a big set.
That's a huge set. And here comes one of my favorite shots of all time coming up. It's going to be the reverse when they all get collected.
But in order to get this experience properly, the way Kubrick meant it, and its most deeply affecting way, you have to see it in the theater at 70mm stretched across your eyesight.
I can't watch it on an iPhone.
it is definitely not an iPhone movie.
I understand.
There it is. Look at that.
That is absolutely gorgeous.
It's very cool. You guys, I'm totally with you on this. I'm as much of a nerd for the vistas of Mars and of the moon as anyone could be. Just like, that is freaking awesome. But that's what pictures are for me. I separate myself from the experience of this just by the nature of, I feel like we could have handled this in a different way.
But
and that's not right or wrong. It's just I always feel like this like vroom, vroom, vroom thing with Kubrick.
Kubrick, I think, is the great definition of art is whatever you can get away with. I have so much more respect for an artist who says, I poop on a canvas and then I rub myself around on it and jackasses pay me $5 million.
I do too.
Yeah.
Sure, yeah.
Then like, well, here's what I was going for with my art. But if you don't understand, then it's your problem, because it's actually very clear and it's important that you understand. And there are filmmakers that come from both stripes. And, you know, I think Kubrick was just very much I made a thing. I'm going to go home and maybe later I'll read if you liked it or not, you know. And the fact that he was able to be that guy, and for whatever reason, he was able to have a career. I say God bless him. And there are other – Bertolucci is another guy who – Bertolucci – there's not a single Bertolucci film ever made that I – like, you know, and I haven't seen all of them. I've seen like two or three, enough for me to go, fuck that guy. But but I went to see Bertolucci talk at one of his movies years ago. And, you know, he came to present one of his movies. It was the one with Jill Clayburgh when she was an opera, played an opera singer. Wasn't called Aria or something like that.
It was The Matrix.
Yeah, The Matrix. And I watched this, you know, 90 million year long Italian something or other about, I don't know, some kid growing up and God knows. And it's like, oh, the last thing in the world I want to hear is this guy talk about it afterwards. This is going to be excruciating. And this charming Italian fellow gets up and he was like Roberto Benigni. And the audience, which was all film students, the audience all
beards
said,
and hats.
Yes. They all, you know, and smoking pipes and, you know, virtually. And everyone brought their A game as far as I'm going to ask a question of the great Bertolucci. And boy, they had their film school questions. And they were like, so in the scene with the boy at the beach house, were you trying to imply that there's a reverse edible complex? Because I noticed that on the left side of the frame, and I'm like embarrassed for my own species hearing these questions. And they would ask this question, and Bertolucci would absorb the question. He would go, I don't know, it could be. I mean, actually, what happened was that day the sun was very bright, so I said to the camera, let's go from this side. And the boy, he came in the wrong side. So I don't know. But that's interesting what you said. And so I was like, wait a moment. I think I like Bertolucci after all. And
here we go.
This is where they hear
the signal being
the signal, because we're going to have the shot.
And I skipped what is another an important, what I think is a very important point is just before that, you know, these guys came to the moon where there's an alien artifact and this amazing thing, and they're coming to study it. And what's the first thing they do?
They get their picture
taken.
They get a picture of themselves in front of it. Like they're at Disneyland.
That's a statement about what humans are.
What they're valuing as importance.
Yeah.
And so, it's the idea that there is no sense of awe. There's no sense of what is awesome anymore. And because they're flying into space, and he's watching a TV show.
And
they fly to the moon, and they're watching a TV show. They're more worried about the sandwiches and the food and the fact that they're traveling in space.
And parallel with that, the idea that we haven't even stopped to think, like, maybe we're still just, you know, apes playing with bones to somebody else.
Right.
You know, that maybe there's something bigger than us still out there. It's like, no, we rule. We're in charge of everything, you know.
We've got to figure it out, and we're good to go.
Right. But which goes back to the mundane thing is that, once again, going off on your thing, is that to the alien intelligence, we are mundane, and this is all we can do when we have the technology. We've taken the bones, and this is what we do, and we're going to the moon, all right.
Oh, look at them. They figured out how to spin their spaceships. Isn't that adorable?
Yeah, that's
great. Glad they got there, at least.
So the Discovery, of course, is just so damn iconic. You know, it's just one of the great, you know, people will usually recognize, like, people who don't love hate never saw 2001, they know Discovery.
I remember this shot in particular, seeing that in stretched across my entire vision at the Egyptian for the first time.
And what's great about Discovery is it's another of those ships that, you know, it looks cool, but it makes sense. It works.
Right.
It is really what you might have.
Now, here they did this shot by having the cameraman, I think it was in a gimbaled, some kind of contraption. And literally the whole set is rotating. So he's up
so literally, this is a big cylinder, and the cylinder set is actually rotating, and he's actually running around like it's a giant hamster wheel.
And he's up at the top, and the cameraman's okay, all right, I've got to get this shot, and he's moving around.
And what's great is
even better is a shot coming up.
When Lockwood, this is Gary Lockwood, when Lockwood finishes his workout, he's sitting at that table having his meal when Keir Dulles walks all the way around. Lockwood is strapped to that chair.
Here we go, in the shot.
Like, this is great.
And this is where it was a tough shot to get. And Brian De Palma did a not as impressive but credible attempt to redo this kind of idea in Mission to Mars which was a smaller thing, but a nice set anyway.
Well, here's another physics nitpick of this. While the space hotel is large enough that makes sense as a spinning spaceship, the sphere of Discovery is not large enough. For a spinning spacecraft to work, to create artificial gravity that way, it has to be a certain minimum diameter. Otherwise, the gravity is going to be different enough, stronger enough at your feet than at your head, that your body will be able to tell that gravity at the top of my body is weaker than at the bottom, which will freak your brain
out. Your inner ear will have a certain weight, but your feet aren't feeling that same weight.
So spaceships, they're have to be a certain size so that your brain doesn't...
So here's the shot. Lockwood is currently upside down, pantomiming having breakfast over there.
Yep.
And now Dulles is... Kiss Care Dulles entering now. Care is going to...
Kier Dulia, I believe it is.
Canadian.
How would you pronounce it, Canadian?
Whatever you said.
I think it's Stulia. I could be wrong.
I thought it was Delay, but it's okay. He was on the Star Loss. That's all I remember.
Yeah, there you go.
Star Loss.
I've always heard Delay.
Well, he was also on Star Trek, the second pilot of Star Trek.
No, that's Lockwood.
Oh,
that's Lockwood. You're right.
Yes, Lockwood. With Sally Kellerman.
Which is, so Lockwood is also notable because that's actually the original pilot. That's the pilot for Star Trek.
No.
It
was the second pilot with
Ryan
Shatner.
Pardon me. Yeah. Menagerie is the first pilot.
Right.
Where No Man
with
Has
Jeffrey
Gone
Hunter.
Before.
Yeah.
Where No Man Has Gone Before. He's the bad guy in Where No Man Has Gone Before. Anyway, so Lockwood was just hanging upside down there until they rotated the set around for Delay to come join
him. That's pretty high up to be upside down.
Yeah.
Yep. That's probably a 60-foot diameter.
Here's a fun thing that someone pointed out. Notice that Lockwood's meal, he's got brown, he's got green, he's got a white thing going on there. Remember that for one sec. And the fact that they've got this pad. They've got the iPad.
Yes.
which they've established, and they do it. They do a nice job where these guys carry this pad around and kind of casually throw it down, and then of course at the time they had to bury an entire television behind it to get it to work. But they've got these pads that are just look like they're haphazardly thrown on the table, but that's actually a very complicated rig that they've put together to make that work.
Oh, I thought that was in the table. Wow.
No, it's their little iPads they carry around.
Mm.
But
I learned something new about this film.
But this is iPad. Yeah.
But this 40 years ago.
Hal, yeah. I love Hal.
And here's Hal. We'll talk about Hal in a sec. But the point I'm making is look at Delay's meal when you see Delay eating. So they're watching this news broadcast about themselves.
Right.
Look, he's all Mr. Earth Tone. he's all about the Earth Tone, and he's even arranged a pleasing little palette there for himself.
And it's interesting how they've layered basically two levels of the film. I mean, basically they're explaining what they're doing, or the official story, and then you see the mundanity of what they're doing
on
this trip.
It's an as-you-know, except buried, so it doesn't feel like an as-you-know.
Right.
It's, because these two guys would not sit here having breakfast going, so what's our mission again exactly?
Let me tell you. So, Gary, what are we doing out here again?
What are we doing out here, Philip? I don't know, Terrence.
And then they can point out the pods with the other three scientists.
It's a genius, as you know, buried in the fact that it's an interview in which they are compelled to explain what they're doing.
And the technology looks great.
Still looks dead on.
Awesome. It still looks great. It looks like the future.
Yeah.
When's it going to come? I want it.
When does this happen?
We have it. There it is.
There it is, right there.
Except that says IBM.
Yeah.
Which,
oh, damn it.
Yeah. Kubrick, you screwed that one up.
Ah, boy. At least IBM's still around.
Well, you heard the story about the name of HAL, how some people think the name of HAL is just the letters of IBM shifted over by one letter.
It's off by one letter.
Which Kubrick denied up and
down. Yeah, he said, that's just letters. It's coincidence.
Yeah.
Now, HAL is both a wonderful, terrible thing for movie history. Because I think HAL is great, and of course, he's again iconic as all hell, or all HAL, you might say. That red eye is just people I think don't even know what 2001 is. Still, I think know the significance to that big red eye. That just means omniscient uber computer that will probably kill you.
I know HAL. I didn't know the discovery.
Yeah, so there you go. But HAL also, and HAL makes sense for when this movie's made. This movie was made in 66, 67, released in 68. And HAL, of course, he's the HAL 9000. HAL is a supercomputer because in those days, that's how you did it.
Does he control every function on the ship?
He controls the whole ship.
He is the mainframe.
Yeah, he's the mainframe. Because in 1967, that's what a computer was. It sat in a room. And it was a colossal thing, and you made it as smart as you could so it could do as much as it possibly could.
And what's great about this is that right now they're interviewing HAL, and all you do is you see that red eye, and it's immobile, but I mean Douglas Rain brings it to life, and then you see HAL's point of view, and this is how I see the astronauts. They're puny little things.
With
this incredible fisheye angle lens going on.
The problem with HAL is because he, created such an indelible mark in movie history is to this day, in fact, I was reading about something going into production yesterday.
People do that shit.
Where, goddamn, if people don't have, every ship has a computer, and how people can, live in a world where,
There are six computers in this room right now.
Yeah, I'm making...
More than that.
Yeah, and...
Well, six computers, plus all the electronics. Not touching each other.
And
we learned 40 years ago that you can't make a computer so huge that it knows everything that, to the point where it can run a spaceship and have a conversation with humans. And even if you could do it, there's no point to it, because what happens if, say, like in 2001, it breaks down? wouldn't you like to have a second computer just in case your computer goes down? Well, of course, that's, you know, we learned that lesson 40 years ago in every facet of life, except in movies, that we don't have a computer for anything anymore. We have computers. We have them in our homes. We live with them every day. And yet somehow, when it's time to make a spaceship, we only give it one computer, which is, just makes no damn sense. It's just the laziest, laziest screenwriting to give your spaceship a computer.
Well, it's to, as a storytelling device, it's to anthropomorphize the ship or whatever.
Well, the thing is,
it just becomes a lazy device.
You would have a computer that is the computer that talks to the people.
Right.
Then you would have the computer that
works to the other
computer. Yeah. Right. Then you would have the computer that controls the sewage system. And then you would have the computer that controls the oxygen plant. And so on.
I say, you know, yeah, I mean, again, Mother's a very good example of that in Alien.
Yeah. Mother, yeah, at least, but Mother, obviously, one of her functions is not particularly to talk nicely to humans. She's not particularly built for that. She's very user unfriendly. So anyway,
she's like Portal.
Yeah, so yeah, exactly. So here's this scene, which, if we were calling this a standard movie-making hero's journey, we would go, this scene is unnecessary. Because it really is. This scene is about nothing. But considering that's half of what Kubrick's movie is about how all of us humans have, you know, used this incredible universe of wonderment and technology to do nothing of interest with, that's the message of the scene. So here's this really kind of painfully embarrassing, you know, scene in which this family uses interstellar communication to talk about birthday cakes and cars.
I can kind of see the symmetry of that now that you put it that way, where it's most movies will show you what you are not doing. This movie shows you what you are.
Yeah, it's true. It's as Patton Oswalt has, you know, it's like we have an iPhone, you know, you have an iPod mini, you have a thing the size of a stack of quarters that can play every song ever written by mankind. It's a miracle. And no one cares. You know, that's the world we live in. It's like, yeah, so.
Well, seriously.
Halfway to Jupiter talking to my folks. Kind of bored.
Right. But I think, I mean, I think in terms of story, what it reveals is that it's the folly, it's the sin of not appreciating where they are. But then again, they have to live life and they can't be in awe every single second of their life. But he chooses to show those moments where, okay, I'm on a spaceship and I'm doing what I'm doing. And
which, granted, even if you put me on a spaceship and sent me to Jupiter, I would be in awe a great deal of the time. But there would still be moments where I would be bored out of my mind.
I'd be bored out of my mind. I don't want to spend – I'll say something and let Brian vouch for it and save you the 30 minutes that he had to experience. I get deeply excited at almost every little thing about the future. When the iPad came out, I almost had a panic attack. I got drunk and started talking about how it's Star Trek now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I would not...
It's true.
I would spend every single second... It's like that scene in Firefly. I love that moment in Firefly. It's like, but psychic? That sounds like something out of science fiction.
Yeah. We live on a spaceship, dear.
So...
Yeah.
I love that moment where it's just like... But you can... I would be Zoe. I'd be... Dude, we live on a fucking spaceship.
But the thing is, you can have those moments all day, every day, today. Just the other day, we have a computer hooked up to our giant TV screen. So we had iTunes up. And at the bottom, it tells you this is how much music you have. And it tells you in days. And it was like 89 point whatever days worth of music. Yeah. I was like, it took Jules Verne less time to go around the world than music you have. Yeah. You could give Jules Verne that playlist and he could circumvent the globe.
And never hear the same song.
I went off on another mini tangent the other day where I was watching TV, and then I reached down and pressed the space bar to pause it. The wireless keyboard space bar next to me. I just paused it and walked away. And I got almost to the bathroom before I went, whoa.
Every time I get out of an airplane. Every time I fly somewhere, I get in a giant metal tube with a bunch of fat-ass Americans and all their crap. And in a couple hours, I'm magically transported to the other side of a continent.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I did that a little over a year ago to see a black president get inaugurated.
Yeah.
Holy crap,
it's been
people.
A big decade.
It is the future. Well, I mean, if you look at Catch Me If You Can, they definitely tried to capture that time.
Yeah,
and the
transition.
I mean, there was definitely during this time, there was a deep appreciation or just a fascination with the future. And I think to some extent, I mean, that's changed all the way through. And here...
We're on the far side of it.
You know,
we got there and was like, well, it wasn't all great.
Right.
Well, yeah, but that's the whole thing that I have now where I'm very... This might have something to do with who I am individually as a person and just what excites me. The parts of this movie that excite me, that's the same part of me. Or it might be just a vague statement about now, but I get deeply excited about all these new things that are coming out right now. Like, in all of our lifetimes, we're all alive right now and talking about it. Things have changed that much, yet my generation might be the last to be deeply amazed by this rudimentary connecting of everyone on the fucking planet. Like, next time we have a new breed of people going through their whole 10 years of school, they'll have had that the whole time. I was alive the day I got a phone with a all the knowledge in the human universe button. And it's called a web browser.
Yeah.
But my nephew, who already at four, like we were talking about before the recording started, my nephew at four and something already has his own iPhone, already has his own access to the sum total of human knowledge, and will never think that is weird or be amazed by the novelty of
and
that.
For the rest of my life, till the day I die, I'll still be like,
we're going to be telling our grandkids.
I know the Dewey Decimal System, motherfucker.
Yeah. There's an interesting, I was reading in an essay just the other day, which is something I hadn't really
hadn't done in a while.
I've done that all the time. It articulated something that I hadn't really, I sort of was feeling, but hadn't articulated, you know, enough the way this article did, where it talks about how, you know, as time progresses and this world becomes more, you know, the way it is, I'm certainly seeing this now that it was described. People are losing the joy and or, you know, sometimes frustration, but the importance at times of not knowing something and, you know, some bit of information and being having to spend time wanting a piece of information and not having access to it. Because that's like a fundamental drive of, you know, it's like, well, I remember most of my childhood. That's how I spent my time, wanting to know things and not being able to find them out. I wonder how you make movies. I wonder who people are who make movies.
I should go on some kind of journey to figure that out.
Yes, I wonder. I guess I'll need to physically walk down the street to the library and hope they have some of the information that I need.
Badass little Death Star graphic there.
Actually, and this is a plot point that comes up where Hal starts talking about the, I think it's the some piece component of the satellite that may be faulty and they have to go check it.
Yeah.
Right. This is an important plot point where Hal essentially is telling them, hey guys, I think this piece on the radar dish is going to break in a couple hours, so go fix it.
So there's a couple hours. Good luck.
So go fix it, essentially.
Yeah.
I like how he gives him a couple hours and not like, yeah, next week.
Well, he gives him a
next year,
whatever the time period is.
Is another nice little head fake of a scene.
Yeah.
Nice little use. Now the mundanity, there is something else going on. Kubrick, unlike himself normally, he is giving, it's also character development, because there's a demonstration here of the difference between these two guys, who are the only humans actively on the ship. Lockwood is just, it's a job. Lockwood is the guy who's like, yeah, whatever, you know, folks are calling, you know, all right, fine. He's there to drive the ship and get it where it's going and get home again. Delay is the one who sketches. He's the one who, and you know, who plays chess. It's deliberate. He's the one who arranges his meal in a pleasing palette of color. I mean, that actually is intentional. He's the one who, when the awe is presented to him, is able to
get
appreciate it.
And you know, there's something interesting we're talking about awe in this whole deal. I mean, if you watch this, I mean, practically every sequence has just this thing that makes you go and look, wow.
What
I mean, even though I'm looking at this
looking
40
at?
Plus years later, I know how they did it.
Yeah.
And this is still amazing to look at. And it's just this building of just...
And you have to think about it, because awesome what that was the foreground rotated until they got to the hub, and then the background rotated. The foreground froze, and the background started rotating. You know, it's
must have been a ramp, because it wouldn't have done that seamlessly.
It was seamless.
You can well, no, really? It's not seamless. If you're looking for the moment, you can spot it.
Okay.
It just kind of clicks.
Yeah, but... you know.
Related to what you were just saying, Trey, Dorkman, I don't remember where he got this piece of
another iconic image.
It might have been that's cool looking.
Yep. Wait, I'm looping back just briefly, we're talking about the mundanity of it. It's the mundanity of the tasks, but it's the awe in how it's presented. So the whole visual sucks you in seeing just the normal task of what they're doing. And that's what reveals the awe of the whole
experience. The pods were just the most awesomest thing ever.
And these things, one of these shows up in Watto's junkyard in The Phantom Menace. as if to say, hey, I know what sci-fi movies are.
I know things about science fiction, guys.
I know, well, you know, on that level, if you guys are going to allow him to do that, how is that different, and don't laugh, from Lucas saying, I want to make a sci-fi movie about the dispute of outlying tax routes?
Because that Phantom Menace isn't about that.
Yeah.
Phantom Menace was supposed to be an action-adventure movie. It just ended up being 2001 for kids.
All right. Anyway, Dorkman's thing was that... no, that was a stupid point. Dorkman's thing was, for a long time, for like the last maybe 80 or 100 years, before that, no, but in the last 100 years, there's been about one world-changing thing per generation. The frequency was pretty solid. In the last generation or two, we've had a increasing number of world-changing events per generation. So people are getting numbed. People are more adaptive now on a level that weirds out previous generations. People who are growing up now and will grow up in the future will be so used to world-changing events that it won't affect them the same way.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the definitions of the industrial age, is this idea that before the industrial age, a person would be born, live, and die, and see maybe one major difference in their generational lifetime, and that's how fast change progressed.
Like electricity.
Or the printing press came along during one generation, and that was it for a while.
Yeah.
But with the industrial age, technology finally hit this cumulative point where, for the first time in human history, multiple things came within a single person's lifetime. So at the beginning then, and it has only gotten progressively more condensed as time has gone on, people see more and more fundamental changes to our society and our technology and our the way we view and do things in the world as time has gone on. From our parents' generation, it's, there's the moon travel and there's, propeller from jets, and for us it's like the internet and cell phones. And
so cute the way you said my parents' generation, as if one of them isn't in the room with you right now.
Because I was gonna say propellers to jets, that's wacky. What?
The assembly line, prefabrication or anything like that. But
yeah, I was gonna say, like, right. Electricity, like, you know, like,
or indoor plumbing.
Yeah, living in London, like when they went from gas
to
electric.
What was it like before we had indoor plumbing, Gus?
Outhouse.
It's about the same. Well, just smelled bad.
My mother's parents had an outhouse in Atlantic City way back in the day.
Like, for me, the, you know, propeller planes, I was, you know, propeller planes to jet planes, I was aware of. I remember my parents having a conversation about, it takes off, like, right away. It just doesn't go halfway down the runway. It just immediately, it just takes off, and it goes really, you know, they were amazed. First plane I ever flew on was a jet. Later I flew on a prop plane. I'm like, oh, this is what it used to be like. Okay. But, just to give an interesting cultural perspective is, one of the things to this day that still freaks me out, and I haven't had personal experience with it directly, but because it was so mind-boggling when I was a kid, when it became a thing, I'm still boggled by the concept, even though it's practically commonplace. But the concept of taking organs from one person and making them work in another person still freaks me the hell out. Even though one of my best friends is on his 13th year of having had a heart transplant. It's like the fact that you could take the heart out of a person and put it in somebody else. Are you shitting me? That still freaks me out, because that was a radically crazy thing that they were starting to do when I was a kid.
Sarah's just going apeshit over here, wanting to make points, and we're talking about
because this whole part
of the movie will give you time to get your points in. Go ahead.
Right, I mean, it was a whole part of the sequence, and starting with it where they showed, I mean, the Discovery in the background, you saw those two asteroids just kind of glide by, nearly hit the camera. I think this was, for me at least, in my lifetime, the first thing that communicated the vastness, but also the emptiness and the isolated nature of space, which is the fascination. The thing is, there is nothing. Well, a shot from in Titanic, the shot, you know, when it's sinking, and then he cuts back to very hard, far back.
They're launching a little signal flare, and it's like
tiny little ship out in the middle of nowhere, and here you are in the middle of, space.
Talking about nowhere,
nothing. And here they are. They've got their ship, and he's out there, middle of nowhere, and he's going to go.
It's a nice little cheap effect. The polarizing of the visor is, small but effective little git.
Nice. And wait, look at that.
How'd they do that?
I think it's a lighting trick.
With a computer.
Yeah, they did it with computers.
CGI.
One big computer.
Is it like a rear projection face on the inside of the mask, and they're just turning it off?
No, they just turn the lights off on him.
Yeah.
And it's crazy, I know.
Well, it's interesting that he's not catching any light from the
outside. Could have been a polarizing trick. If you had a polarizing filter and you had polarized glass and you
just
opposed
it
now, maybe that would do it.
That
would be
cool. Now, this is pre-green screen, so how did they...
There was green screen, but you could tell when you see green screen, you know. How'd they do the moving background over there?
Yeah, is that matte?
It's probably a matte, yeah. It's if he never crosses it, or even if he does, I mean, he's all hard-surfaced. It could be projected.
Yeah, there's no hair, really, to try to comp around.
It'd be a hard mat, but it looks pretty clean. So I'm imagining it's probably a projection, or it might even just be a background. You know, it could be a white, you know, a black cloth with some white dots on it. I'm sure the book covers it. The making of pictures, I remember, are usually in a black soundstage, with whatever they're using as a star field.
But actually, in real life, you would not be able to see the stars moving at all, just because the difference in perspective is so great that it wouldn't appear as if there's any motion.
Unless they're rotating.
Right. But,
yeah.
I mean...
He's not on a rotating section of the ship.
It is interestingly effective. Though that's the one thing that when Star Wars came out that really changed things is the way they used the stars essentially as a background to give you a sense of motion through space, which we've never seen before.
Right.
Really. As effectively, too. And here we're back in the ship and they're
analyzing. So, yeah. Plot-wise, at this point,
Badass. That yellow one. This one looks cool, too, because I understand that it's impossible to do that. But the other one was just a cool look.
Yeah.
See? At this point, Hal has said, go check out this piece of equipment. It's going to fail. They bring it in. They test it and go, no, it's not.
It's nothing wrong with it.
They're about to talk to Mission Control and say, we think Hal might have made a mistake. And that scares the crap out of us.
That's going to be a bomb going off.
Yeah. And I like it. It's his fish eye.
He did a what?
And you get the nice big close-up of Hal, and it's always Hal's always in the picture. And
he's always there.
Yeah. I'm watching you.
There's no hiding.
Are there multiple
lenses
eyes?
Yeah,
around the ship.
That's how he sees.
And you'll notice not just one central red thing.
Right. No, he's all over. If you notice, the front of the pods have Hal eyes on them. Hal sees out of the pods. He sees through the pods when the pods are in motion.
But there's no Hal in the bathroom, right?
We don't know.
I don't think we see a bathroom in this movie. Just the exterior of the one.
Just that one that...
But he's not in the pods.
Yeah, but Hal is the ship. You know, he's everything.
I remember reading that Kubrick hired, I think the actors... I mean, it's slightly for their flat aspect.
Their blandness, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're just truck drivers, you know.
Yeah.
Slightly more educated than, you know...
It's a popular thing in acting to say, I don't want you to do anything, just, you know, don't do anything. Don't try to act, just be. And I can imagine that being 10 times more difficult in this movie because you're being asked to do so little.
Dude, just chill.
Yeah, just sit there and lean.
Just sit by the computer and the giant thing. And just hang out.
But on the plus side,
these guys don't have to handle nuclear physicist faux dialogue. I mean, everything. Right. The other conversations are very straightforward. Like, I think he's having a little problem, don't you? And I think he is. And you know, they're being concerned about that, but, you know.
Because there's no need to talk about his tertiary algorithmic functional algorithm.
You don't know how that stuff works
out.
Anyway.
I think he might be breaking down. Well, that conveys all the information you need.
And the thing that, and again, it's Kubrick's, you know, crazy choice, the way he chose to make his movies. But, you know, the answer and the explanation of everything, there is an answer and there is an explanation to everything that goes on. They just don't give it to you during the movie. In fact, they don't explain what the hell's going on with Hal until the sequel that somebody else made 20 years later.
So wait, what do they say in 2010?
In 2010, they explain the overall problem is what happened to Hal is that these two guys... They're there to maintain the ship on the way to Jupiter. They don't know what the mission is. They have no idea. They don't know about the monolith. They don't know any of that stuff. They're driving the truck. The sleeping guys know. When they wake those sleeping guys up, they're the ones who know what the mission is. So they can do the mission to try and figure out where the monolith signal was going. That's what the mission is about. These guys don't know that. Hal knows what the mission is about, of course. But Hal can't tell them.
Wait, what's the point of the mission again?
Is to figure out where that signal from the monolith sent a signal to Jupiter. They're tracing where that signal went and what was it trying to contact?
Okay, does the audience know that at this point?
Nobody knows that.
Nope.
Like I said, unless you read the novel,
right?
Or watch 2010.
Well, I think Haywood Floyd later maybe reveals that.
Do we ever know there's a third monolith in this movie?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not Floyd. It's a military officer, I think. When he finally kills Hal, when he deactivates Hal, that's when that mission brief plays, and it explains briefly it sent a signal to Jupiter and they were sending Discovery to try and figure out what it was trying to communicate with, and that's when Cara Delevingne finally finds out what the mission was all about.
Right.
But the point I was making, though, is that Hal knows what the mission is about, but he's been ordered not to tell them, and they just don't know that it's a problem of Hal's makeup that makes him insane. He can't know something and conceal it. His job is to disseminate information and interface with the humans. And it's making Hal insane that they've told him not to tell the humans something. So...
Oh, I don't... I was with you until you said that. That seems like a weird choice.
I feel like
the humans are being idiots thinking, I deserve to live. And their whole thing was just, no, you kept us going in the right direction. Now we're done.
I've read it differently, that it's the whole thing with the breakdown in the equipment is Hal just making a mistake. And Hal is not built to handle the fact that he could make mistakes.
He's getting paranoid about it.
Yeah. But he makes a mistake and he goes, oh, crap, I made a mistake. I can't do that, and then that proceeds to cause
and he proceeds
to insane.
Snap. But that's but the at least what's posited in 2010 it's Dr. Chandra, when Dr. Chandra himself comes and repairs Hal, he places the blame on it. He says Hal, you made him nuts. You made him. You told him he had to lie, and that made him insane.
Is Hal actually anthropomorphized, or are they anthropomorphizing him?
Here's the plant. Yeah, later.
Yeah, a little setup there.
Does Al have a Hal have a personality, or is? Because I was going to say neither of those things are traits a computer would ever have.
Well, that's
he wouldn't go apeshit because he couldn't tell you something.
Well, that's the old thinking that we're going to make computers, and computers will get bigger and bigger and bigger and become sentient.
Right.
Now they might, as a network, become sort of sentient, and of course, then they'll kill us and make Terminators.
Yeah, but is he sentient? Is he?
He's supposed to be, or he's simulating it.
If he's simulating it, then that's not.
Well, then you get into the deep philosophy of it.
Yeah.
You get to the point where it's like Hal could not go crazy because Hal is ones and zeros.
Getting into the philosophical question of what is an approximation of human sentience and what is human sentience and what's the difference.
And if you're getting into like a neural network situation, which is neural network, might have been theoretically. I mean, Hal means heuristically programmed algorithmic computer, doesn't really have anything to do with neural networks, but. You know, the experimentation they've done with neural networks is freaky because neural networks are like brains. So, our brains are neural networks. And you can build a neural network, and of course it has to have more connection points. The more connection points it has, the smarter it's going to be. We're nowhere close to being able to build a neural net that has anywhere close to the number of points of an animal brain, even much less our brains or any brain.
I think we've gotten up to mice.
Yeah. We can make it as smart as a mouse.
Right.
Now, what you do with a neural net, though, is
it was a cat, actually.
Yeah, you can.
They might have gotten a cat by this
point. Maybe they're up to cat. Depends.
Did the cat brain eat the mouse brain?
As we all know.
Well, they gave them spider legs, and then they just ran out of the lab, and nobody's been back since.
And it'll end badly. As we all know, the intelligence of a cat brain is highly dependent on which cat we're talking about.
Where's Tesla?
Yeah, where is it? But anyway, when you. Weird thing about neural nets is, neural nets will literally learn. I mean, you can literally say, I want you to point your tracking device at that white dot on the, you can kind of give it that instruction, and then it'll just kind of flail until it does it. And then it goes, okay, I learned how to do it. You don't know how it knows, but you gave it the tools.
But it knows.
But you gave it the tools to understand what the goal was and how to know when it hit the goal. How it achieved it is up to it, just like it's up to every human. Like, I want you to go over there and give grandma a kiss. We'll eventually learn to do that inside of our brains. Why are we doing it? And what do we think that process is really about? I'm going to give grandma a kiss so she doesn't eat me. Might be what we're thinking, but it doesn't matter because all we know is we're giving grandma a kiss properly. So when you tell a neural net to do something, it might go, yes, absolutely, I am happy to do it, so that the Crustorians don't come to the fourth dimension of Kreton and melt my brain. Your computer might be insane, but as long as it's following instructions, you'll never know. So if you give it the tools to do terrible things, then you might find out, gee, it was actually insane the whole time and just manifesting being normal. So,
and here we get a very direct visual piece of information. So. Hal is reading their lips. This is the point, actually, when I asked my dad, what's going on? They're reading their lips.
And I always wonder, it's never been spelled out, I wonder if the fact that Hal always reads lips, does Hal even listen to things?
Does he have a microphone?
Intermission!
Yeah. Wouldn't that be simpler? Because it's like they just put the eye up and he reads lips, They don't have to have audio for Hal everywhere he goes,
Well, maybe it's not perfect, but in this particular instance, he was able to get enough information to make bad things happen.
That's right, because they know they're going to do something.
So we're in the intermission now. Does the intermission run in real time? I guess it's probably not on a DVD.
I would imagine they cut.
Does that mean that we are only halfway through the movie?
No, it's a little bit more than halfway.
A little beyond that, but I feel like more or less halfway through.
I understand that Kubrick, I have something to say, and like knee-jerk went straight to make a movie about it. It's cool to do the whole monolith thing, but I feel like
I don't think knee-jerk is the right description at all.
Monolith was.
I know. I'm just saying.
That's an idea. In fact, that is an idea, and you can make a movie about that. Is what I mean. It's not knee-jerk in the sense that I need a camera and the movie's done. Oh shit, that was amazing. I need a cigarette. He had the idea and decided to make a movie on that idea. I feel like the coolest idea in this movie, and which predates what 30,000 sci-fi movies would be 30 years later, is I'd rather see 2001. Focusing on the guys and how it goes crazy, and that's the movie. Lose the first hour and just have the movie be, this is a story about these two guys dealing with an insane supercomputer. And you'd have all your vistas and you'd have all your pieces of information.
Well,
I feel like
that would be an action adventure movie of which
no, it wouldn't have to be an adventure. It wouldn't.
No,
have to be
that's you're an MTV generation child, and you want things to happen. You want splody.
I understand, you know?
and that's what 2010 was more like.
Yeah. I would be interested to see 2010. It's not an action movie. This would be a psychological thriller, if anything, but it would be slow paced and slow. And
well, that's fine.
It would have the exact same tone.
That's not
of this.
What Kubrick wanted. Kubrick made this, and you didn't enjoy it. He's okay with that.
No, I know
right.
that.
I mean,
I'm
the thing,
okay with
the
that.
Thing here is that Hal, in a way, was incidental to the whole thing. Hal was like the fly in the ointment for the aliens.
I know, but I feel like he sort of glossed over the coolest idea in the whole thing.
He was more concerned about...
I feel like you don't get what the coolest idea of the whole
no,
thing is.
No, trust me, I'm right there with you. And that might be because I've read the stuff that he hadn't read yet, or seen the movies he hadn't seen yet. Right. Monomyth, or the whole... Not mono, the monolithic... What is it? The thing, the big rock.
Monolith.
Is it monolith?
Yeah.
That's a really cool idea. I'm so there with that. The fact is, at this point, I'm used to that because I've seen it in 1,000 other things, perhaps influenced by 2001. That's a fucking cool idea, but I'm really used to that. At this point, I'm also used to the insane supercomputer, but I feel like that is the more cinematic idea to display. The monolith is a book, not a movie.
The difference is that Kubrick is more concerned
short
about...
Short story, actually. It's yeah. not even a whole book. It's a short yeah. story.
The difference is that Kubrick is more concerned about theme than plot. If you were more concerned about plot, then yeah, we would start the story later and we would focus it more on the ship and the insane supercomputer. And there goes...
Hey, we're back.
And
we're back.
But because he's more concerned about getting these ideas of theme across, then we see... Then we get all of this. We see the apes to the dawn of man. We see the process
and
the mundanity.
And
this
is why I get agitated about it.
We spend 45 minutes to an hour on the mundanity of what these people think about space travel, because that's crucial to the theme while not necessarily crucial to the plot.
Right. I guess what I don't understand and can't is the impact. I can't viscerally understand the impact of this. All I can understand is that it's an insanely... pretty movie, both in its effects and it's just its basic camera work, and the visual aspect of it is amazing. I don't see this as a work of genius, even kinda, and that's partially for the same reason I don't understand why symphonies are the way they are. Like I don't understand the yardstick a insanely talented composer goes through to create a symphony, because I don't understand the logic at all.
My analogy was going to be I can't tell the best opera ever done from the worst.
Right,
one.
It's the same sort of thing. Where it's like I don't know what makes.
But
this
somebody
good.
Can. There are people who appreciate it and can tell. You know, can
well,
tell
yeah, but,
the good
it,
ones
but,
from the
but,
bad
but
ones.
But usually,
and why.
Well, but the and why is the point that you know, once you understand that, all of a sudden you can understand it on their level. And no one's ever explained 2001 to me in a way where I went, that's what he's doing, and now I truly appreciate it. They've only explained it to me, and they have, and I go, I see that's what he's doing.
Well,
that
the thing is,
that doesn't make me enjoy it anymore.
If Kubrick himself was in the room, he wouldn't explain either, because he wasn't about you getting what he was doing. He was about doing it and going, what did you get?
Well, yeah, and I would have nothing to say if you guys had said, the only thing I loved about this is that I was seven and the effects were amazing, because that's a visceral experience that you had as a seven-year-old. But you're talking about the brilliance of the movie.
It is brilliant.
Yeah.
And here, actually, this is a really interesting turning point right now, is because yeah. everything's been... This is where it turns malevolent.
Yeah.
It's
also the closest... other than the ape getting attacked by a leopard an hour and a half ago, this is the only thing resembling an action scene in the whole movie.
Right.
And it's not... And they cut away from it.
But this thing is so freaky. Even now...
But yeah, this is such an ominous thing. Like, oh! And you immediately got like, oh! And sure enough, boom.
Bum, bum,
Hal drives it.
Bum.
That was five cuts, and he's dead.
It's like, and then now... What just happened?
And
oh,
you
son
get
of
it.
A bitch.
You totally get
yep.
it.
Yep.
And there's simply no greater situation of being fucked than
yeah.
this.
Yep.
Yep.
Well, he does get revived in 3.
Jubal Early would agree
That's
with
true.
You.
He's as dead as you get.
And look at that. And Hal just sends the pod screaming into space.
Yeah. And the fact that, you know, they are now, at least in this scene, you know, everything is ballistically rotating correctly. But, you know.
Look at that. And, I mean, it's amazing. This is 68 they did this.
Yeah.
Again. Before we actually walked on the
wow,
moon.
Wow, that's a really wide lens.
yeah. part of the point here, at least the way I read it, is to simulate the Hal's state of mind. Because Hal looks through the fisheye lens.
I guess I can see what you're saying there.
Yeah. I mean, everything here is
And it's also
wide.
To make a small set seem much, much bigger.
Okay, all right. I was trying to
make yeah, sense. Yeah, I know. It's actually a very small set.
That's the thing. I mean, there are philosophical film... film student... considerations to be had, and there's also practical considerations to be had.
Right. Yep. Explosive bolts.
I mean, they don't exist mutually exclusively.
Hmm.
I wonder if that'll come up again.
I don't know. Maybe. Maybe not. Okay, maybe. Now, my question is, why did Bowman go into the pod without the helmet?
Because he was in a hurry.
Oh, I hate when that happens.
it's an oversight. Definitely an oversight.
Because he's mundane. And now he's excited. Okay. Because it's the old thing in like movies, whenever you're in combat, you don't put any helmets on the actors, you can see their face and their head.
Yeah. This also is, you know, it underscores, always thought it underscored kind of nicely the whole idea of how slow everything is. I'm on a rescue mission. It's like, I'm almost out of the garage. I'm really close. If I move really quick, I might be able to catch him in another 10 to 15 minutes when he'll only have been dead for 20 by that point. Mm-hmm.
It's like the little guy from Innerspace.
I think the pod from Innerspace definitely owed a lot to 2001.
It's the same sort of look.
And the pod from Explorers, too, for that matter. Explorers, I think, was kind of trying to make a reference to 2001. With the
any pod in movie history
since. The Tilt-A-Whirl. So, yeah, now there's this excruciatingly long rescue sequence of very, very slowly catching up to the body of Poole.
Well, yeah, because Poole's moving at 70,000 miles per hour.
Right.
And he's moving at, you know.
Yeah, 65, so yeah. It's going to be a while. So.
Right. But once again, it's the whole pace, the mundanity of the whole thing, what it takes to get something done. And he's not cutting ahead. He's just sticking with the whole thing.
In fact, there's the shot coming up where we're just looking out the window as the body gets closer very slowly. And it just goes. There's a shot that lasts forever. You know, it's a shot that, just like most of the shots in this movie, the pace of it, you would just never see in a movie made nowadays. You know, you just wouldn't see that.
I mean, the great thing that would, I'll call it cure delay. You look at him and even with just what's not going on, you get the intensity of everything that's happening. And you have everything. Of course, there's a whole thing of all the monitors reflected in his face.
Very sexy. Oh. The real thing that made 2010 possible was the fact that, however many years later, when did they make 2010? Late 80s?
Actually, early 80s.
Early 80s.
Yep.
that Cure Delay hadn't aged. That he was able to, you know, come back and do more, you know, play a cameo as Dave Bowman and put the spacesuit on and look exactly the same as he did in this movie. Considering that was now 25 more years ago, he probably looks a little older now.
I'm probably got some gray going on, but, yeah. At the very least.
But at the time, it was kind of uncanny how it's like, holy shit, the guy, he literally is some kind of strange creation. He hasn't aged a day since 2001.
Here's your shot.
Yeah.
There it is.
It's like, just going to hold on the speck that gets incrementally larger.
Well, I mean, I think it's common also in how it's – so he know. I mean, he's got to know that he's dead or at least something's terribly wrong, but still he's going to get him. He can't just let him go. He has to hang on to the other – he has to hang on.
I figure he can't let him go, and also because he can't actually be sure that he's dead. He maybe just can't communicate. Maybe he's unconscious.
Well, true.
Just check for sure. once he grabs him, then he's going to – oh, yeah. Nope. Yeah. He's dead.
I think I always took it to mean as at this point he knows that he's dead, but it's that primal human instinct of I have to leave no man behind. I have to go get my
either
buddy,
way
exactly. Give him a proper burial.
Safe. Now a little behind the scenes moment here. I mean, we're going to cut to an exterior of the pod and a stuntman on wires who clangs into the pod, but notice that it's a slow-mo shot and do the math in your head about how hard that guy is actually hitting the pod when you see the actual contact moment when the stuntman smacks into the arms.
I like the starlight filter on the lights.
Like, I got you, buddy. He's going to be okay. He'll be as right as rain in a moment.
Everything's going to be all right, man.
You're
going to be all right.
The interesting thing is just watching this. Have any films come to reproducing this this look?
Yeah. Get this. Oh, I'm just spinning in space. And bear in mind, this is a slow motion shot. So he's spinning faster than that.
And
four, owie. Yeah. Oh, ow. Uh-oh. Oh, wait, ow, damn it. If I wasn't dead before, I am now.
Yeah, that probably would have snapped his neck into there.
And oh. Then, you know,
a good pantomime on that stuntman's part, by the way.
I love Ray Lovejoy's editing in this once again. It's just always cutting out at the right moment.
I want to go for the cheap shot and go, there's editing?
Yeah. Oh, I was going to say, editing? I don't know. It's like, okay, we take this roll of film, and I'm going to splice it to the next roll of film, and there we are.
There's editing.
So,
look at now. So it's like, okay, I'm crazy now. You want to mess with me? This is what happens.
Here's where
I'd be interested to hear your... the way you present the genius of this movie and how you feel about it as... Because you're obviously very deeply moved by it, so I don't ever want to just outright you know, be crass about the way that I don't feel the way you do, but I mm-hmm. want to know what your relationship is with the brilliance of this movie. Like, how do you feel? It is genius. I'm basically asking you to lay out its genius for me.
Well, is it just the
combination of all the choices at work?
Well, I think there's lots of things going on here. I think this film, for me at least, was seminal in shaping my taste of film and what can be done with film, and the sense of control and the sense of storytelling. And also, I mean, I'm watching it now, and I feel this looks amazing. And it somehow it just brings me back to, I'm not saying exactly my feelings as a 7-year-old, but it still feels just as vital and visceral somehow. In how it's there's economy. It doesn't deviate at all. I'm with the whole thing. I know the film now. The thing is, for a long time, you know, I didn't know what the story was. It was repeated viewings, and then once I got to understand it, I gained a deeper appreciation. And the interesting thing is, it's still always just really economical storytelling. For me, it's enough. It just kind of hits all these little points in how it tells me what it needs to tell me. I've absorbed the whole story before, and now I'm watching it again. It doesn't bore me in the least, and we don't even have the sound on it. That's the amazing thing.
Yeah, we've talked about before the weirdness of how. It's interesting to compare one movie to another and go, wow, I bet you that's an easy movie to watch with the sound off. It's like, no, that movie, you can't you can't watch that movie.
There are very few movies that need Watchmen dialogue less than 2001.
Watchmen clocks in at over 3 hours, and you don't feel a moment of those 3 hours, even with the sound off. Anyway.
Right. But also, I think it's for me, there's definitely an existential angle to this, and me being an existentialist at heart.
Sure.
It speaks to me. And I mean, the whole vastness of space and the emptiness and loneliness. And here they're the tip of the spear. Here they've been thrown out. They don't know. They're like monkeys going into space, going towards Jupiter. They have no idea what they're doing, and they're just doing everything they can as humans to try and manage to get to where they're going. Now, of course, this changes in the last act a bit, and that I don't know if I'm on board with some parts of the last act, but definitely some parts I am.
What do you think? Economical storytelling, and it tells me what I need to know. What does the movie tell? What are the things that the audience needs to know that the movie conveys? Are they the symbology of it all? And
I think the thematic
symbolism.
The thematic qualities of it. That like what we've been talking about. The
isolationist and
the mundanity. Look at what we as essentially hairless primates are capable of doing, and the places we're capable of going. And look also at how we're capable of not being impressed by that at all, and how quickly we can become used to that, and how
we can always find a way to screw up,
and
right.
how we can screw it up. But
can we posit
that
that's
duality.
What Kubrick's saying? We're doing a lot of reading here.
Yeah,
that's definitely what he's saying.
he speaks extensively in that book. Kubrick was never much. Did he ever do a commentary ever for anything? I don't think he ever did a commentary.
He wasn't
big on DVD. He certainly wasn't big on widescreen letterbox DVD. In fact, he was refused to let his movies be released letterbox, you know, during his lifetime. But or was against it at all. But no, he talks about, you know, there is in that book. And there's a very one of my favorite chapters as a kid in that book. I remember, and I found it when I was flipping through. I think he's a teenager named Margaret Stackhouse wrote him back in the day before the internet. We had to write letters to people, and she wrote this multi-page letter saying, "Here's what I think 2001 was about." And Kubrick wrote back going, "You nailed it." You know, it was
wow,
like
nice.
she was like the one of all the letters of people going, "Here's what I think this trippy movie's about."
Did they publish her letter?
It's all in there. Her letter and his response. And he just goes, yeah, pretty. He actually didn't say you got it right, but he said that was the most insightful analysis of the movie I've seen.
Now here, what's interesting here is that up until now, it's all been about, in a sense, technology. It's been about learning how to use it and using the bone and then making the tools and getting out here. And now this is the point where the technology has now turned against the humans.
And I think there's a lovely image. There's an image here of him, like literally, it's like he's holding a sacrifice. Like, no, please, may I come in? I bring sacrifice.
And the moment that we just passed with Keir Dillia, this is the first time in this entire movie where we've seen really any emotion whatsoever.
Yeah.
He goes, yeah.
He's like, uh-oh.
Fuck.
Because now there's real conflict.
Yeah.
He's like,
you didn't see it with Hal. How you saw with Hal is that, you know, what they did is they just cut into a super mega close-up of Hal's eye. It's like, okay, I'm going to take care of you now. And but so now it's him.
He's just fully realizing that, oh my freaking God, you know, it's like Hal's not
incredibly screwed.
Hal's not going to let me back in. Hal's nuts. Hal's freaking lost it.
Right. And now I have to use the technology is, well, he's not thinking that, but on that, the whole thing is the technology is against him. And he's got to use his tools, what he has. He has to give up essentially the last remnant of humanity, let Frank Poole go, and then somehow attack the technology that's essentially, you know, kept him alive, essentially brought him out here into space where he could not survive without technology. That's the big difference. I mean, it's not like going on a ship across an ocean to some land. I mean, you know, if you're on an ocean, you can get on a raft. Here, he's out in space.
Well,
the
raft
is
a piece of technology as well.
Well, it is.
Oh.
But you could swim.
Because we're not supposed to be on the ocean any more than we're supposed to be in space. You know, it's like the ocean is not our native environment either.
I think a better analogy, a better comparison would be walking out into the middle of the plane somewhere. You could stand out there naked and there'd be no technology and you'd be okay.
You just go
hungry.
Because
that's what we're built for.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the only thing we're built for.
Yeah. We're not built to be in space, and technology is what allows us to be in space.
Right.
And this just is a great example of the frailty of who we are as people. We depend on this, and it has to work in so many different ways just so we can survive.
Right.
I'm reading this book now, or at least I'm scanning it and looking for what he was talking about. Mm-hmm. And there's a thing here that says, Kubrick has talked on three different occasions about the cuts, and one, two, three, just various examples. Number two, I made all the cuts in 2001 and at no one's request. I had not had an opportunity to see the film complete with music, sound effects, etc. until about a week before it opened, and it does take a few runnings to decide, finally, how long things should be. Asterisk, here we go. Especially scenes which do not have narrative advancement as their guideline. It's weird to hear him say that.
So he's saying,
this has nothing to do with the story.
As we said, it's not what he's doing.
I just never heard it from his mouth.
No, we're not making it up.
No narrative.
We have studied Kubrick. We know that he was not trying to be, Steven Spielberg.
Not every scene was about advancing the plot. Yeah. Every scene necessarily was about advancing the theme, but not the plot.
Right. And I forget who it was, but someone said that, Kubrick was a filmmaker, but he approached it like being a painter. I mean, it literally is just sort of, I'm going to create this, instead of one image, like a painting, I'm going to create this series of images.
Well, he's creating the environment, really, through a series of moving paintings, if you want.
Yeah, that's back to the idea of, it's he's not creating not every movie ever made is the hero's journey or has to be. There are other kinds of movies. It's just that most movies that get made that are mainstream are hero's journeys because they're movies about heroes. Because as a species, mostly that's the story we want to hear. We want to hear about the guy who killed the dragon. And most every movie coming out of Hollywood is going to be about a guy who kills a dragon in one way or another, and therefore it's the hero's journey. But there are other kinds of movies, and there are other kinds of art, and there are other kinds of experiences. There are different kinds of theater, and not everyone enjoys every kind of theater. I'm not a big fan of opera, but I enjoy a good musical. Go figure, because they're almost the same. But, this is a Kubrick film, and therefore it's not a Michael Bay film, and it's not even a Peter Hyams film. It's one of these.
It's interesting. The thing with Kubrick is that his pace, if we're going to talk about him and Michael Bay, is his pace is so much more stretched out. And one person it reminds me of is Michael Cimino. And if you look at his earlier films.
Talk about hit and miss, too. There's another fellow.
Yeah, but if you look at his earlier films, even Deer Hunter or even Heaven's Gate, I think even Thunderbolt and Lightfoot a little bit, just the way he stretches out his sequences and how long it takes him to develop what happens, but his hold, his control.
Watch this, Teak. This is important. This is another iconic.
There's
a lengthy setup here, though. He's got to do all this.
Right. I forgot. It was 2001 Space Odyssey. We still have 15 minutes.
Yeah, he's got to go through the whole process. The thing about this that I remember, and I can recreate it as best I can without the sound, is the final alarm horn.
The sound design is very, very important because it is. Like most of the rest of the film, at least in terms of story, the sound design is so sparse that when it does bring something up like this alarm sound or earlier when the life functions were being terminated on the hibernating astronauts, when he brings in those kind of klaxons, it carries a power that if you had those exact same sound effects like in, say, a Michael Bay film, they would not carry that same presence that they do here.
Yeah. Right. Sounds
would have lens flares.
Yeah, true.
What I really like about the action here, actually see her caution explosive bolts again. This is like the second or third time he's done it. And what I like about this is that Bowman just does not hesitate. He's like, okay, I know what I have to do. Okay, fine.
The great little moment here when he squinches his eyes, like, oh, this is gonna suck.
Oh yeah. That's in reaction to it. But he knows he's like moving through it. It's gonna happen.
And then he's like, oh fuck.
Yeah, and it's the klaxon.
And then it goes silent. This scene goes totally silent.
Quiet. Boom.
And a great wire effect. It's like he's being towed up and down a vertical shaft.
Yeah.
And so it's completely silent right now. Until the moment where the door slams and then
the air rushes in. At least he doesn't land because the gravity lets him sink.
Yeah, thank you for having the gravity not come on when the air
comes
on.
He appeared to be trying to hold his breath. Don't ever do that.
Yeah, that would be an error.
That would make your lungs explode. Don't do that.
If for whatever reason you find yourself being blown out of an airlock, helpful tip.
In space.
Exhale.
But the moment before, take as deep of a breath as you can, and then once the actual decompression starts to happen, exhale for as long as you can. That's how long you have to live, basically. Then you have a few seconds after that, but,
This almost bugged me. He had a red suit, and then he put a green helmet on.
Yeah, well, he doesn't have his red helmet.
Well, it's conflict.
He's not good at ensembles.
Oh, yeah. That's good. I like that.
It's
he's in conflict.
Idea.
He can't
conflict.
Accessorize
that's right.
with a damn.
I'm going to slap everybody in the world.
Well, it's very important to the thematic underpinnings of the philosophical mise-en-scene.
Yes,
the technology is no longer working. Things are now to the level where he can't have his own helmet on.
Yeah, exactly.
Where he's not styling anymore.
Well, he's abandoning his, formerly artistic sensibilities now. Just red with green. Who cares?
That's right, because
we're making
drawing.
Fun of it, but there is a certain point to be...
Yeah.
It is just a way of showing this is chaos, this is...
There is exactly, there's no
future,
order, right.
Yeah, in this future, everything is planned out and works perfectly. This is just another way of saying things aren't working perfectly anymore.
And the best way to show that is by having everything perfect until the moment where it all goes to shit.
Well, exactly. I think he grabbed a spare helmet. Obviously, he didn't go back to the main pod.
Right.
He just grabbed an emergency helmet or something.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's not spelled out, but the question, the unanswered question and the answer that follows is, why is he even wearing a helmet? Well, that's because Hal could dump the air out of the rest of the ship.
Yeah.
Right. Right. It's like he doesn't have to wear a spacesuit to deactivate Hal's brain center. The ship is full of air, like always. He's just doing it as a precaution just in case Hal gets squirrely. So he doesn't have to be wearing a spacesuit. He's just doing it. He's doing
I always
took
it to
it
mean
safe.
That Hal had already dumped the air. So
no, it hasn't. Like, but he's
he could. Yeah,
so there's no reason he could.
He could if he wanted.
Well, there is gravity. Well, never mind.
Yeah.
Not in here. There's not. Again,
that's
this
right. Now here, okay, it's green because all it's
Vegas.
All red now. So okay,
and green contrast conflict.
Well, you can't see the green anymore. It's all red light until it's the little white lights.
Now this and talking about an iconic scene. This is yet another. Iconic scene.
Is this the Daisy scene?
This is the Daisy scene. It's which again, I think people, people probably tend to know it, even though they may not know why they know it, but they know that there's a thing that exists in the zeitgeist.
That's me.
They just get it. So,
which for my money is still one of the best death scenes on film ever.
I got it.
Ooh.
When you look at it.
Yeah, it is. You're right.
And it's a completely non-personified...
Absolutely a death scene, certainly, but although the computer death in Portal, I think, is a good close second.
Well, it's very similar.
It is very, it's very similar.
It's basically the postmodern version of Hal dying.
Yeah. I think the computer death in Portal is actually quite good.
It's a video game.
We keep referencing Portal, and Sarah's just still like, huh? What's that?
What's Portal?
Portal basically makes...
It's a great
Hal
video game.
Basically makes Hal a... sassy girl robot, but she's not like she's still a Hal.
But just as megalomaniacal,
she's just this sort of
megalomaniacal.
Why must computers always be crazy? That's what I mean.
But she's snarky as shit.
Yeah. So at the end, the boss fight basically is where you're in the room with the computer, and bit by bit you knock off components of it because it is a networked intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And every time you knock off a component, its personality changes because it's lost that part of its personality. So computer, this is in Portal, goes to these different sort of
so at
phases.
This point
I like how he skips some component. You skip number
that
six
that one we
I'm
need
like, why
that's my iPod
that's
music
support.
Collection
yeah
and obviously we're not hearing it but at this point Hal is pleading with him and telling him I'll be good I promise I'll be good I
no,
swear I'm
really,
not gonna
I meant to not kill everybody no I'm serious
yeah
oh he actually goes back or at least in that shot he went back but looks like a continuity
Hal didn't
error.
Kill the ones that are sleeping right
he did
already
yes.
He shut their systems off.
And part of the theme...
So Hal's going crazy.
Yeah.
As opposed
well,
to...
essentially...
These two guys weren't necessary. Hal is just going nuts.
Well, I mean, for all intents and purposes, it's perceived as crazy. The thing is he's self-preservation. It's like, you're going to kill me? Okay, I'm going to kill you.
Well, no.
Hal started it.
Well, no, but his stated...
Oh, no, he
no, no,
screwed
no,
up.
No,
he screwed up, right.
The order of events was... He screwed up. They freaked out. They said, we may have to deactivate him. Nice. Hal didn't want that to happen. Not because he's like, no, no, you won't kill me. It's because he wants to complete the mission. That's his primary goal.
Right.
And so when the answer he gives to Dave when he strands Dave outside is, why won't you let me back in? Hal says, the mission's too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it. That's his answer. That's his justification.
And that makes sense. For him, unfortunately,
it sucks for
Dave. I
would
think
the people that he killed would be important for the mission.
No, apparently they're not.
Yeah.
Apparently, you know, he is,
not according to Hal.
He's the one.
He is malfunctioning, so he might not be making the best choices.
Right.
But he knows that Dave will deactivate him, and so you know he's got to keep Dave out because he was right. Here's Dave deactivating him.
Right, because Dave figured out how to get back in, and Hal thought he had him, so Dave is now able to do whatever he needs to, which is survive, and he's now killing the mainframe.
Yeah, this is the happy ending because clearly in what he understands of the universe, now that he's destroyed the computer, he'll live forever. He'll live a long, happy life on a spaceship by himself.
Well, he won't be killed out in the dark of space waiting for Hal to let him back in.
Right,
but isn't he in a very fancy hotel room.
Isn't he equally screwed at this point?
Like, yeah, it's not a good choice.
I mean, I feel like what he should be doing is reasoning with Hal.
Yeah. But there is no reasoning with him.
And I think he realizes that, yeah.
Hal just killed four people. I think he's sort of beyond the pale of, I wonder, where's the, maybe we'll just reboot him. Maybe we just need to.
Right.
Where's the last system restore?
We did not have to leave Hal.
You know what it was? It was that damn GPS software I installed. If I just go back to a clean install.
It was Half-Life.
But
the interesting thing here is that, notice what you could have done. It could have been a small little room, and instead it's this long rectangular room with many, many, many banks.
That utilizes not only the four walls, but the floor and ceiling, because it's zero gravity, so there's no reason not to utilize.
And here we go.
So
here's this message.
So here, yeah.
This is Hayward Floyd.
This is Hayward Floyd. Yeah.
Yeah. Floyd. And Floyd's giving the quick little brief about, he's basically explaining what there is to know. Delay is like, son of a bitch, that's what it was? Okay, I'll be darned.
And this is Hal's last act before he completely, quote-unquote, dies. He has this in his memory bank, he goes, okay, you've got me.
Yeah,
I'll tell you. The mission still has to be completed, so here it is.
The thing that I wasn't allowed to tell you, this is what they were telling me not to tell you.
So now you have to carry the ball to the end.
Yeah, buddy.
Good luck.
Good luck.
Hope you don't screw it up.
Well, because this is the end of essentially, I guess, of the second act, we'd say. And then we go into the third act where things get a little more hard to grasp.
Yeah, well,
in terms of motivation and everything.
The second act?
Yeah.
Yeah, basically.
And the
because this was like the end of the movie of the movie.
Oh, well, you could say that.
I know that there's more, but I feel like we just.
Well, but it's the mission. That's the whole thing. It's the mission.
We've gotten to the end of what story there is, and now there's just the ride is all that's left.
Split screen thing?
Yes, and the hotel room.
It's coming up.
So,
and so they fade out, and it comes back.
Normally it does, yeah.
Beyond the infinite.
See? Yeah. Now it gets a little tricky, and you got to watch carefully.
Not that that'll necessarily explain everything.
Because I didn't see, actually, the first few times I never saw it. The monolith just kind of floating by. And you got to look carefully for it.
You only see it when
it
eclipses.
It's there.
Where is it?
It's in the upper left. There it is.
Yeah.
Oh, there it is.
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Yeah, I didn't even see
it. Yeah, there it is. Okay.
Well, okay, that's a little bit more obvious.
Yeah. And it's like, there's a monolith out of here.
So is this three distinct short films-ish, maybe? Like, it's got three acts that are all sort of their own.
You could deconstruct that way. The same way you could deconstruct Full Metal Jacket.
Three different stories that add up to, an overall thematic idea.
Yeah. Because then this becomes, I'd say, the least concrete. And
actually, yeah, because unto themselves, the first act is a story, and the second act is a story, and I don't remember the third act. I just remember pausing it, and then I don't think I finished it.
Well, if you're going by that, then there are three acts, and we're now in the fourth act, because there's the Dawn of Man story, there's Hayward Floyd's journey to the monolith, there's the discovery scene, and now we're in the fourth story, which is peripherally the discovery scene. It continued, but it's sort of going in a new direction now
because now this is going to it's going to fulfill the mission of the film, which is contact. Yeah. They sent the signal.
All right.
We're going to go find out what the hell that was about.
And now we've just watched scenes of the monolith traveling through, and we have no idea where Dave is.
Where are you?
We did see the discovery going towards Jupiter.
Well, that's
Jupiter.
Yeah, that's Jupiter.
So in a way, the monolith is coming to join Dave.
By that, it looks like Jupiter has five Galilean moons, which is not the case.
How many moons does it have?
It only has four Galilean moons. It has 20 or 30 or some ungodly amount of moons, which are essentially captured asteroids, but in terms of moon moons, the way we think of like Star Wars moons,
right?
It only has four.
How many space stations?
That's no moon. It's a space station.
That's no space station. It's a moon.
And Endor is a moon also. Or the moon of Endor.
The moon of Endor, yeah.
And here we have Discovery, just puny, tiny, right next to Jupiter.
Which, I mean, that's the thing about space travel. It's all a matter of perspective. Yeah. There's nothing human scale in space.
I feel like I haven't represented my understanding of space, which is unbelievable, melting awe. Yeah. At the scale, at everything. I'm right there with all of those things. Excellent devices for storytelling.
And that's what
I just feel like. This is a series of weird choices. It works really well for a lot of people.
I think the part of it is that this movie is trying to tell you something that you don't actually have a problem because, like you said earlier,
that's it. Thank you. You just put the. I'm serious. I'm not being sarcastic. You just did it.
Yeah, I think that's what it
that's
is.
That's it.
Because you see the iPad, and you go, oh, that's awesome. You see iTunes, and you go, that's awesome.
I've got chills, man. That just took a load off my shoulders.
What sentence did you say that solved the problem?
The movie is trying to tell me something that I have no problem accepting before the movie started.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
The iPad is awesome. iTunes is awesome. Airplanes are awesome. Oh. 2001 is going, all of this stuff that we can do is awesome. Wake up and pay attention to that.
Right. I mean, look at the title. The final act is,
and then there's stuff that's so awesome that it'll make your brain melt, and you'll never understand it, but it's awesome.
Which is ultimately the thing that really lands the film is this last act, is that it goes Jupiter and beyond the infinite.
I'm watching now, it has my full attention.
Yeah, but unfortunately, it's all it's going to do now is to show you. You know, it's
here's
it's,
the alignment.
It's Michael Bay without the tits now is all it's going to happen from now on.
Well, that's fine.
But
tits are always
space tits.
There's definitely space tits.
This is definitely space.
I've never
tits.
Had a feeling like that. That was like a high just for a second there. Just like,
oh, good.
I really deeply just went.
We actually captured the moment.
Right.
I just want someone to make me understand what's going on and. That fucking did it.
But look,
I'm glad I could connect those dots.
But look at the title also. I mean,
Space Kubrick, Odyssey.
Exactly. Kubrick and Clark did use that to refer to the whole thing of the Odyssey.
The Great Journey.
It was a great journey.
That's nice.
See, right there.
That's
all
very, very
in
cool.
alignment. All very. Look at the symmetry.
Yeah. And again, we're missing it, but the music, the sound, yeah, it's just
that's the Ligeti.
Bananas.
Oh, can we talk? Let's talk about the Ligeti for a second. So there was a problem, and Giorgio Ligeti did sue Kubrick successfully for distorting his music.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Even though it's very effective. And here we go. Trey, take it away.
Slit scan, ladies and gentlemen.
Trey, you have to understand, you're talking to people that don't know what opticals are. Explain this ground up.
Thank you.
This is it's a technology that's like primitive now and was, you know, before. I never got a chance to play with it because it was gone by the time I got into the showbiz business. But it's slit scan, which it's done with very long exposures of different colored cutouts and shapes that you actually move by the camera. We couldn't computer move a camera, but we could do it. Hold the shutter open and move things past a camera, and create these blurry, strange, you know, effects. And then it cuts to all kinds of other things. There's chemicals and gaseous interactions being shot, and all kinds of different.
So for my money, the most interesting part is this beginning.
So this is what blew everyone away. Now.
What do the units that are sliding past the camera actually look like at normal angle? Are they just pieces like construction paper?
I couldn't really tell you. It's
that's weird.
Yeah, well, that was that yes, that
it's
was.
A slit. Let's just look up slit scan in here in the world when all information is available, and you know it's a purely optical mechanical thing that the way to do it.
It's like iTunes.
Yeah,
that's really really cool.
It is. It's like now it looks like your Windows Media. You know, do you want visualization? No, I don't want visualization.
Though a slit scan visualization would be really cool.
What was barely at our, you know, the limits of our movie making technology is now the thing that everyone immediately turns off as soon as they start a new Windows install.
Now watching this, you know, back in the day or even watching this, not knowing anything, you're going like, what the hell is going on? But according to the story of this is basically Bowman started going through a Stargate, which has been set up by the aliens, so to speak, if you want to get literal about it. But of course, you go to the movies, you're going like, I'm just going along for the ride. I have no idea what's happening, but clearly something's happening in his head, something.
God, that's really cool.
It is absolutely gorgeous.
So you can imagine on drugs what this looks like.
it's contact. Well, it's contact.
At this point, the drugs are for now.
Contact gives you a narrator who explains it. We'll go to another world. This one's much more violent. it's the same sequence of just, you know, without the crib notes to sort of help you understand what the hell's supposed to be going on.
Right.
And it is just, you know, it's...
And the rowers keep on rowing,
and there's just no way of knowing. You know, even
this is one of the chemical
that's one of the chemical shots, effects. That's some kind of chemical reaction.
This is like what Aronofsky did.
Exploding star. You know, well, and I grant you, even at the time, you know, I was...
That is stunning.
Yeah.
That is amazingly
yeah.
cool.
Yeah.
Even at the time, at the age of 7, I was like, "Okay, come on, just get to a point of some kind. Come on,
I'm actually more down for this than I was for the rest of it."
Ooh,
this was really where I started. What's going on, Dad?
This is just
what's cool. Is
like,
if
what do you say? Like, over
the
this?
Last shot works for me because
look at this. All chemical effects, amazing,
unbelievably cool. How do they? What am I looking at?
Read the book. Well, they'll tell you.
That, I can see. That's just liquid.
That's a chicken being born. It's a chicken embryo.
Well, it's a model upside down, shot backwards through some fog.
Yeah, exactly. That's what that is. Yeah,
no, it's literally some chemicals.
Embryonic.
Yeah.
Wait, is this the star?
And you know they just dropped liquid into a tank like 30 or 40 times.
Oh, my God. That looks so cool. Yeah. That's like Star Trek.
It's pretty. Anyone got any weed?
It's better than Star
Dude, that
Trek,
is,
man.
I'm serious. That's really awesome looking.
So this is 68. You've seen everything. Oh. I mean, all this technology, all this order, and then here he goes into this. Yeah.
If only they'd had a computer to do these effects with, but they didn't, so they had to think of something else.
Well, the computer probably would have snapped and gone crazy.
Yeah, they tried it with a computer, but it killed the crew. So then they had to fall back on some other technology at that point.
ILM's little-known origins.
You know, once again, I mean, skipping to another film, this totally reminds me of The Fountain with what Aronofsky did for all the effects. Because you know, Aronofsky was going to use CGI, and that got too expensive, and the whole thing with redoing it, and he said, this is the way I'm going to do it.
Oh. Which is just so much more beautiful than any computer can make.
Where do lava lamps fit into the zeitgeist chronologically?
Several years later, early 70s.
So a lot of the guys that were like, dude, I went to see 2001 25 times and I did 25 acids.
I take that back. Lava lamps are around because they're very much
60s.
Okay, cool. I was going to say, it'd be really funny if lava lamps owe their existence to people who saw, had great memories, had a great trip watching 2001.
Now, an important thing about the late 60s, mid to late 60s also, the whole mod scene had come on and, you know, everything was groovy and everything was starting to turn into the fashions that we know more in the 70s.
It's my happening and it freaks me out.
Okay, that is
Someone spit on the lens there. I'm sorry. Did you have to see that?
The music really helps this.
Yeah. Well, like I said,
you can hum.
You know, even at the time, you know, when I was 7, I was kind of like, all right, you know, let's step this along.
Exactly.
Are the adults watching the movie at this point in 1968 going, are they separating themselves from it and just going, that's awesome, or are they getting frustrated with it?
They're doing whatever. And again, you have to...
I watch this going, oh, that's cool.
This was going to the movies, again, in the 60s and 70s, the entire movie industry and the way you perceived the movie industry was completely different than the way you perceive the movies now. You know, and the whole concept of going to the movies and why you went to the movies and what you expected from going to the movies, you know. People would come out of a movie and they might go, I didn't get that. I didn't understand that. And it was okay to have said that.
It's like, I didn't get that one.
Yeah.
Right.
I didn't get that one.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Well, better luck next time.
Obscure context was acceptable, and you have to figure out what the hell was going on.
You know, you went to the movie, and, you know, you knew maybe innately, like, you know, what you kind of expected from movies because you'd seen movies, but you didn't go, and then at the end, there'll be a giant explosion. That's movies today. Movies today end with a giant explosion. If you don't get a giant explosion, you kind of go, I was dissatisfied with that movie because movies end with giant explosions. You know, this movie, you didn't know what the hell. You were going to get a thing, you know, and you all you knew was, you know, your friends said, I saw that. It was wild. It was crazy. It was interesting, but everyone's talking about it. You might want to check it out. I don't know, see what you think. But you got what you got, you know. You came away from it. No one understood this movie the first time it came out. Nobody did. People only thought they did, you know. Right. They just go, I thought it was about this. I thought, at the end, isn't it God saying don't go into space? Yeah, sure, if you like, whatever. you know, sure.
I mean, this...
You want it to be that, then it's that.
No, this is just Stanley Kubrick's, never go to Utah thing, because I was high the time I went.
Well, I think it's coming to Utah. I think there's the Hebrides also.
Yeah.
It's so distorted visually. Also,
are we going to see any Vasquez rocks, or is this all in England?
Yeah,
this is all the American
Southwest,
West.
Yeah.
But it would have been
B-roll stuff. It would have been sending somebody out.
Just grab some film in a helicopter and went.
Yeah. So I mean, this part, even again, to me at the time, this was kind of like, well, this is just
This is working for me.
This is helicopter shots that are colorized. It's not nearly as cool as the slit scan. You know, you would do it the other way around, end on the slit scan, because that was literally mind-blowing.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this is when, you know, there was a lot of experimental filmmaking going on, and definitely there was some of this on the outskirts of experimental filmmaking, and he just brought it essentially, mainstream.
Put it in an MGM movie.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I'm singing in the rain.
Look at the water.
I'm singing in the greasy. Yeah.
But you look at this water. I mean, you know it's water, but it looks so alien.
It just looks bizarre. So, yeah.
At this point, this part
is the least successful, you know, especially because
I am in agreement.
It's just like sort of artlessly just cutting from, look, we colorize this landscape. Do we colorize this one? Do we colorize this one?
Well, for me, it makes it a tiny bit too literal what the visual landscape is, whereas they weren't before.
To go out of the you know, slit scan. And
also the fact that you can kind of see the iris there in the corner.
a little bit.
But
I'll cut it some slack.
But at the same time, you've just spent 2 hours in one world, and he's trying to do his best in, you know, 5 minutes to disconnect you as completely from that world you've just spent 2 hours in as he can. So
yeah, in a way, he's untraining us visually from what we've seen,
right,
to something else.
Entirely different,
and then
without alienating you completely.
Shadow in that one.
Yeah, exactly. The one thing that's so great about it is then when he finally like, okay, where does this ride end? Boy, it's like you really kind of go, what?
So what are we listening to right now? Just
this is orchestral
Ligeti?
Yeah,
yeah. It's
the weird vocals.
Ligeti, yeah.
And then the color, yeah.
It's going to start changing on the blink.
Yeah,
very soon.
Yeah, which is a great effect.
It's like, wow.
And then isn't it when it finally goes normal? That's when we're out of the sequence, isn't that how it is?
There you go. Here we are. And here he's.
And then here's the.
I'm okay to go.
Here's the exactly.
Okay,
this ending sequence. You know, this ending sequence. Yeah. I always, you know, even as a kid, I was like, okay, I don't understand this, but I like it.
Yeah.
I dig the ending sequence, and
I love his reaction.
He's like, still just shaking from the trip.
I'm so wigged out right now.
Now, once again, remember, this is
he's bugging out.
Yeah.
This is pre-home video.
I'm
you have
so
to wait
freaked.
Years, or you have to go back to the movie theater to see this, or wait several years to see it again and understand it.
Yeah. I don't know which commentary or release
and
first,
or read the book.
But to reference our Groundhog's Day commentary, about 3 weeks to a month in, that's how I would be behaving. I'd have fun. I'd try to figure it out, and then I'd just go for
all right. So what is the most generally accepted explanation for what's going on now? Generally?
They've constructed this reality for him.
Okay.
And basically, in the space of a couple of cuts, we're going to see the rest of his life.
Okay.
We're going to see him live his entire life in this.
And it's open to interpretation whether they artificially age him or we're just covering the span of 60 years
in the
next few cuts.
Yeah, exactly.
Which it doesn't really matter. But it doesn't really make sense that he would still be wearing his spacesuit 30 years after the fact. But again, it doesn't really matter.
It's still trippy.
I think he's just been crazy for the last 45 years.
And where's the pod?
It could very well be I've spent 45 years in this room, and I'm going to put my spacesuit on again just for old time's sake.
Just for old time's sake.
I'll go with your first explanation there.
Yeah.
The non-literal one where.
Again, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, exactly. Once again, it goes back. It's his experience. It's his odyssey. He's not going, they're taking this through his steps in his life.
I love.
To the mundane things. That's the whole thing. What's he doing next?
Yeah. He's going to eat, and he's going to drink.
And he's going to break a glass.
There's so much written about the glass breaking.
Yeah.
Oh, and then he can actually hear. He can hear water sounds and what they use. The echoes of another life.
There is a rich, weird guy with this room.
I hope so.
I hope there is.
With an underlit floor.
Totally.
I want that floor.
It's
actually kind of cool
looking. I love that underlit floor.
Yeah. It's like the ghost of Michael Jackson is standing on every tile. Too obscure?
No, not obscure enough, I think, is the problem.
Not a great old man makeup job.
No, not the best.
They did a better job in 2010, actually.
Yeah.
I like it because what it looks like. Obviously, it doesn't look like a convincing real aging.
It looks off, and maybe that's good.
It looks weird.
It actually would make sense. It can't get old age right.
It feels right that the meat of his skin doesn't hang as it's aged, but the skin itself is... It looks like a 30-year-old guy just went through an experience that made him older, but his body didn't actually age. If that makes any sense. Like, that, I'm trying to explain away what was probably just a...
No, I think...
I mean, it works as well as anything else. Let's be honest.
Right. The vibe of this scene is very much, you know, Kubrick going, someday I'm going to make The Shining. Because this, suddenly this section is just like, feels just like The Shining. It has that vibe to it.
But it's better.
The big empty, you know, spaces and very slowly revealing what's in the next room and the suspense of what is that. Just letting it play out.
Only what you take with you.
Yes. And it's just, and once again, getting back to economy, he's skipping through this guy's life, and Kubrick figured out a way to do it that just totally takes you in through point of view.
Yeah.
And here, exactly, we're still back at Bowman's point of view. He looked back at himself, and we're still sticking with it.
Except it was probably never his point of view. It was just sort of, you know, we're sort of seeing it by juxtaposition of the way the cuts are.
But exactly.
He didn't, like, turn and see himself in a spacesuit. You know, this is just him 40 more years on.
Well, it doesn't tell us.
It doesn't, but now he thinks he's seen it, and now he's going to come and take a look. And we're expecting him, maybe this time he'll see something.
Looks like old Biff haircut.
It is.
If someday a crazy wild-eyed alien hands you this monolith...
I never thought it'd be me.
That's a nice blue robe, actually. Look at
that's
that.
That's a very nice robe. That hotel's fancy. I wonder, can you take that with you when you finish, when you leave Jupiter?
I want to stay in a hotel that has the underlit floor like that.
Yeah.
That would be fantastic.
Can I say I like this transfer very, very much?
Yes. I actually meant to mention that earlier.
Yeah, we're looking at
it. But it's absolutely beautiful.
Probably the nicest I've seen 2001 since I saw it in the theater.
You have to wonder, when was the last time they struck a print?
Yeah. I don't know. When I saw it in the Egyptian a couple of years ago, when I first moved out here, it was plainly a 40-year-old print. Mm. So there were scratches, and I mean, it's still a beautiful movie, but it was clearly an old print.
Maybe actually Warner Brothers, for like the 50th anniversary, can strike a new print. What do you think?
Maybe. Oh, God, nice. I hope so.
Oh, yeah.
Hopefully play it at the Egyptian again or some other, you know, nice house.
Arclight.
Or the Arclight, yeah.
Yeah, actually, once again, when I saw it, was in the theater that actually did the Cinerama
movies. Oh, nice.
Yeah.
In the Dome.
And now,
this is in Montreal.
It's interesting that we're back...
What? Like I said, so much has been written about that.
Yeah.
It's the marriage of the future and the past.
Oh,
well, because the whole
thing is a Jewish thing.
Well, no, that's what some of the criticism
it's the marriage
is.
Marriage of the future. Wow, of all the bonehead interpretations, I never thought it'd
Or
go
once
there.
Again, it's mon. It's wait, listen. It's what's what I read. I mean, for me, it's the mundanity of life, the accidental things. I mean, here,
yeah, it's like, you know, it's like, we just
but
can't,
here he actually
can't stop
takes
screwing
an
up. That's the thing. We're
but here
fallible.
He actually takes an interest. He goes, oh crap, look what I did. Let me check that out.
Check that out. And your penalty is you're going to die of old age. Yeah.
I think that's for everybody.
So looking back,
nice.
What'd you think? How was it?
How were the last 45 years in this one room?
That's some interesting old age makeup.
Yeah, it's an interesting choice to make him bald, like completely, totally bald.
And you know, exactly, and the skin is not sagging that much.
Yeah, that's the problem with the rubber is it's not following
that's
falling
okay.
back.
And then here's like, well, what's he doing?
We there's the tension of what is he doing just play out.
Yeah.
Until there it is.
It's the monolith. Thing. So, okay. Thanks. And we finished our experiment. And
we are now going to do something else with you.
So this is cool and all. And we've made a decision.
If I could just get you to fill out this.
Yeah, if you just sign this here.
Sign this. And
well, actually, it's interesting that he's reaching for it because he, obviously, he's been there for whatever time, even if it's been for a moment. And he knows what knowledge it has, what it means. And he wants it. He desires it.
Remember the first time I ever saw this shot of the Star Baby, that wide shot of it, I'm like, what in the hell is that?
Oh, well, yeah, exactly. If everything's been weird, and now it's like totally off. It's like, what?
So is that a model of a baby?
Yeah, that's a sculpture.
Yeah.
So it's deliberately sculpted to look a little like Cure Delay.
Go all the way, and it goes right into the monolith.
Into black.
And boom!
Yes, and now, yes, he didn't go into black into stars, he just did a cut. It's no optical transition, we don't have time for that shit.
And now we're back into Zarathustra. From the very beginning of the film.
No.
Brian?
No. We're not doing
Ow!
That. We decided not to do that.
Oh.
We did it at the beginning.
Now, in the context of just watching this film.
Our rehearsal was good, though.
Yeah.
I mean, this works because there's no explanation of what it is. You make it of it what you will. Obviously, the Star Child is coming back to Earth. We don't know when. Doesn't matter. There's more explanation of what it is literally.
Are we sure that's Earth
in
the book?
And actually, they had shot some stuff, and they were going to include it, but they just cut it out to keep it open to interpretation.
Yeah. But according to the book, which is much more literal, it's like the Star Child is, you know, the first thing he does is destroy all the orbiting nuclear weapons.
Which we saw at the beginning of the Haywood Floyd sequence.
Yeah.
It is?
Yep.
Yeah.
We saw the orbiting nuclear weapons.
And they had considered putting in the film, but they just, I mean, at some point they took that out.
That's like what I was saying. The satellites in the book are nuclear weapons platforms, and they just didn't convey that information in the film.
And that's it. It ends, and if you look at it, he looks right at us, and that's when it fades out. And then we have more Johann Strauss.
That's an interesting complete sentence for a credit.
Yes.
This film was directed and produced by Stanley Kubrick.
The screenplay was written by Stanley Kubrick.
That's that whole British thing.
Yes.
What does it mean to be human?
It was all in that movie, man. I can't do anything more for you than that.
All right, Brian. 2001.
What does it mean to be human, or what is 2001?
Cinerama.
Cinerama.
No, how do you feel about 2001?
They had to build a whole dome for
that. It really is beyond words, which is a cliche, half-assed way of getting out. But it's just a spectacular, spectacular experience.
Okay.
Being human or 2001?
Both.
Okay.
I agree with the second part.
The one is trying to tell us about the other, and that's what it's trying to do.
Okay.
All right.
Trey?
What does it mean to be human?
What's the question? That was a red herring joke.
Okay.
How do you
Edward Bishop.
Whoa, Glenn Beck.
Glenn Beck's in this.
Oh, God.
And Penny Broms.
Frank Miller. But Ed Bishop.
Ed Bishop
rules.
Yeah.
Right. How do you feel about 2001?
It's funny because this is the first time in quite a long time that I've actually sat down and watched 2001 from beginning to end. So it's actually was interesting to realize what things I didn't even necessarily remember that clearly about it and things I remembered all too well. Danny Grover. Oh, Grover.
Here you go. Designed and directed by.
Really? Kubrick did a lot of his own stuff.
I guess he was a photographer, huh?
Oh, very much. He started as a still photographer and got into movie directing.
I can definitely see that.
So it's interesting to watch it again and see how it feels now. And it's as we were saying, it's not the kind of movies that people tend to make today. And not the kind of movies that tend to get released by studios anyway. I'm sure people are making movies like this. It's just that we never see or hear about them. But they're probably still out there. But Kubrick is not, I've had numerous, vociferous arguments with people who tried to say that everything Kubrick ever did is a genius and is a work of genius. And I'm like, I don't know. I think Eyes Wide Shut's kind of a piece of shit. But, I can see that the same guy made it and I can see that it's, interesting. And, but that for me, Eyes Wide Shut is a movie I watch the whole thing and I go, I don't know what that was all about. Or, it kind of held my attention, but I didn't enjoy it. I wouldn't say I enjoyed the experience. And this one does. This one works for me. Some of his other movies are hit and miss for me. Clockwork Orange is kind of grotesquely fascinating, and they hit me in different ways. And I can't separate the fact that this thing is just so seminal for me personally and the way I experienced it and the way it was to be part of the culture that was experiencing it at the time, because this was definitely a phenomenon movie. And once a movie passes into phenomenon, it doesn't matter if people get it or not. They're going to go see it, and everyone's talking about it, and everyone's aware of it. So this was definitely one of those movies.
Serge?
Oh, what a lot of what Trey said. I mean, once again, seminal, saw this as a child, just fascinating. And I got to say, watching this, I haven't seen it in quite a number of years, the whole thing through, and I still think it's great. It still just captures my imagination as an adult, not even as a child, and just watching it, and it still is relatable. Okay, the whole thing flying through the mountains and all that and the colorized stuff, I still have that same reaction to it, but I think your point was well made about how it allows us to take the journey between, well, I guess I expanded on the point, between the technology and the new world, so to speak. It was of its time, but I think it still it transcends that whole experience, and it is just such it's a visceral, it is, as other Kubrick films are, a visceral experience, as David Lynch films are to a certain extent.
Yeah. Which I can't say that there's a single David Lynch film that I've ever enjoyed, and I've only seen like half of them. I remember bothering to see half of them, but so that he's an example of kind of what Teague's been talking about, is like, I just don't get why people like them. But people do, and I'm okay with that. I don't lose sleep over the fact that people like David Lynch movies.
Right, but once again,
it just doesn't work for me.
But it works, and for me, I mean, I don't like all of David Lynch's films either. It's just that there's a number of them, or some of them, that, once again, these films, this one, even Strangelove, that bunch around that time, Clockwork Orange.
Definitely for me, his heyday of films that I like.
Yeah, I mean, but once again, there's that visceral reaction to it. Once again, it is an experience. You have to sit through it, and you go through it, and he manages through his talent, at least for me, to capture me and keep me with what's going on. And it just captures my imagination.
This movie pissed me off, and Brian just made this movie not piss me off.
Yay!
Wow.
This whole down in front thing has been about me understanding why some people like movies that I don't
like. Sharing and healing and growing.
Never gotten any closer to understanding any movie except for maybe Full Metal Jacket, and Eddie helped me on that one.
I helped too.
Holy shit, you were there. Your hair was great that day.
It's always great.
Well, no, but you and Eddie both approached two different... It's weird. Those are the two movies, actually. You both approached explanations of Kubrick films two different ways, and both worked for me. In fact, yours worked better for me than his did. His was that a lot of times there's something to be said. I think it's some guy's whole thing, and this is what he's written books about, but there's something to be said for the parallel between dreaming and seeing a movie. And how you go into this, when you're dreaming, you start to fall asleep and the lights go out, then you start to see these weird images that don't necessarily relate to anything, and then the lights come back up and you go about your day. And it's just this real thing that happens, and movies are very similar. You go into a theater, the lights go down, you see some images, the lights come back up again, and you just walk away as if it didn't happen. And when you put it that way, and compare it to a dream, watching any Kubrick movie becomes a little bit more sensible, because it's... As we've said before, we've tried to rationalize it any number of ways, but storytelling isn't necessarily what he's doing. He's not saying, you know, this isn't The Shawshank Redemption. This is just, this happened to this guy, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened. And there's a thematic resonance to them, and they juxtapose well, and at the end of the day, you walk away feeling something about what he was showing you. And if he conveyed the same vibe you would have having seen a storytelling movie, then he's done the same thing as everyone else. He just did it a different way, and it's all different and great and equal and wonderful things. And I didn't get that until Eddie said, dude, it's a dream. That's it. Don't think of it as a story. Think of it as a dream. And that was a really enlightening thing for him to say. This, even that didn't work for me. he kind of just blew my mind, man. That was really, really cool. Because the way I'll approach that when I'm explaining it to people later is I'll say, well, you know how sometimes when there's an idea you're trying to convey to an audience who's just not ready to accept it, so you sort of... It's basically a subtlety in the movie, and you're trying to sort of just lay into it, like, you know, the relationship that Fight Club has with the act of fighting. One of the sort of things where you can't just come out and say that because the audience won't accept it, blah, 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 blah. 2001 does that. Only, I was with it before. That's an interesting way to look at it. I don't know if that fully changes my experience watching the movie. It won't make it any easier for me to watch. But the parts that have always held up for me will still hold up. The slit screen sequence is slit scan sequence is really, really badass, and the visual effects are stunning, and the photography is beautiful.
You know, by the way, we should say we were given Alien and Aliens props for being, you know, 30-year-old movie that still holds up and still is a style setter. This is a 40-year-old movie, 40 plus, and when they're doing their space stuff, you know, it's just as nailed now as it was then. And I, again, it is something that just can't be, you know, I can describe it, but I really can't make you feel it. It's like, you know, this, imagine going to the theater and seeing this in a world where Star Wars did not exist, where Star Trek was not, you know, it existed, but was not widely known.
Was not more than 15 inches wide.
Exactly. And, you know, and most people didn't bother to watch it at all. You know, it's like when we hadn't gone to the moon and, you know, Apollo broadcasts were at a rare occasion on television sometimes in the grainy black and white.
when you put it that way, it's like, so basically all the 100% of the force of the fascination they had when they were drawing those pulp comics. Same force, no more knowledge, but they see this instead of the comics.
Yeah.
That would blow your mind. That would crack your skull open and make your blood shoot out like...
This film, in a nutshell...
Thanksgiving.
This film, in a nutshell, is about... You live in an awesome environment, and you are an awesome creation. Whether you want to say that was a creation by another intelligent creator or just a happenstance of biology, either way, you're a creation that is awesome, living and existing in an awesome environment. Appreciate that. Understand that. And just look up and notice every now and then at the awesome things that you can do and that people just like you can do and the places you and we can go. That's what this film is about in a nutshell.
I love you, man.
It's what it is.
Oh. All right. On that note, on that beautiful note, Thank you very much for listening. You can always go to downinfront.net, go to iTunes, subscribe to us, get a brand new episode every single week. Twitter.com/downinfront, Facebook.com/downinfront. Register on our forums, talk to us, explain to us why Brian knows so much about 2001, and Serge knows so much about 2001, and Trey knows, and I don't know anything about anything in the entire world. Go to, there's a third thing, Cafe Press, and buy a shirt. You're a hoodie for fashion.
And always will be.
And always will be. They're never going to go out of fashion. We're going to have bell bottoms and hoodies.
It's going to hold up 40 years from now.
Yeah, you'll be buried in it.
The Down in Front hoodie is going to be your Kubrickian fashion wear.
That's right.
I am myself, Dee Christie.
Brian Hedicek.
Serge Delpierre.
Trey Stokes.
Crazy Jersey.
I'm afraid, Dee. I'm afraid.